Radio, courtesy of tnsradio.com. Tonight we've got two excellent guests for you to have a listen to. I'm not going to waffle on any longer than necessary. We've got Dr. Judy Wood and Andrew Johnson tonight to talk about the 9/11 event and everything that goes with that, hopefully. You're free to call in or text on the northeasttruth.ning chat line. If you've got any questions you'd like to ask, please feel free to just get in touch and we'll pass the questions on if we can get through them all. So without any more messing about, I'd like to introduce Dr. Judy Wood and Andrew Johnson. Hey there.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Hi there.
Excellent. Well, let's get straight on with it then, shall we? Would you like to give us a broad overview of who you are and what the topic we're going to be talking about tonight covers? It's about as expansive as I can make it. The floor's yours.
Who's on? Me?
You go first, Judy.
Okay. Dr. Judy Wood. I've got my bachelor's degree in civil engineering, structural engineering, and my master's degree in engineering mechanics, which is like applied physics, and a PhD in materials engineering science, an interdisciplinary course, and mine was mainly in engineering mechanics, materials characterization, Mori interferometry, that area,
right.
Experimental mechanics.
Excellent. Sounds very technical. And yourself, Andrew?
Yeah, I've got sort of varied background. I did a degree in computer science, finished that in 1986. Then I got involved with doing software development, what's called real-time software for telecommunications, robot control, factory robot control, that is. Then ended up getting into education, and currently I work part-time for the Open University, tutoring some students, assessing other students for disabilities. Just to talk about the topic a little bit, the reason why we're both on together is we ended up crossing paths in the field of 9/11 research, and Dr. Judy has done a huge amount of original research, probably more original research into the events of 9/11, primarily but not exclusively at the World Trade Center, and I'd sort of done a little bit of research into that, but nothing really original on the scale that she had, and we essentially came into contact through this mutually shared interest. I suppose it will have been late 2006, I think, probably for the first time. And that was how we came onto this situation here, speaking with you tonight.
Excellent. Right. Well, that's your credentials well and truly established, and very impressive they are. For the listeners who aren't entirely familiar with the actual thread that we're going to be dealing with tonight, there's the entire 9/11 truth movement en masse. And within that, there's various different strands, hypotheses, theories, you name it. You can probably find every possible explanation for 9/11 that you can imagine out there. The two main ones, if you discredit, which I'm pretty sure we all do, discredit the official version of events, the only real other two issues at hand, I think, are the actual means of how the 9/11 was accomplished. And that's really where both of you come into this, I think. Would I be right in saying that essentially we have a difference of opinion within the 9/11 truth movement about the actual means that we used to bring the towers down and the implications that that has on the wider world. Is that something like right?
Well, I don't consider myself as part of the truth movement.
No, I should have said that.
Yeah, that's a strange entity in itself, and it has it's kind of like a religion of thermite. And I don't know what how they get that to work. It's a welding material, but I'm just a scientist, and I have researched what I have come up with myself, and it's sort of independent of what anyone else has been doing.
Right. Well, that pretty much sums it up. That it's the thermite issue against directed energy weapons is the crux of that particular. Discourse, is it not? Yeah.
I think it's more of a false choice between the official story or the official alternative story.
That's a good way of putting it, yeah.
And you're not supposed to talk about anything else.
Yeah. Heresy.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this is really sort of this area is how Dr. Judy and I first came into contact because I'd become skeptical of the official story in about 2004, and I think, you know, Dr. Judy might explain later on, depending on how the conversation goes, how she became skeptical, like the moment it was she saw it on the TV. You know, she knew right away that something was seriously wrong, and she, you know, and I didn't, basically. And it was in 2004 that I started to look at these videos, you know, that had been put out, and then I concluded at that point, oh, it's got to be some type of explosives in the building then, because we can't just have these buildings burning down. And I sort of sailed along that path for probably a couple of years without going into the level of detail that really was required, I should say, to actually find out what happened. In other words, what happened at the World Trade Center is, in some ways it's actually very simple, but it, when you go into the detail of it, it's much more complicated. And if I may just say that the main thing that happened is that the buildings turned to powder, they turned to dust, and however many bombs you put in the building, conventional bombs, they don't turn the buildings to powder. And I never really stopped to think about this, because going back to the thermite story, that had been put on the table, essentially, as Dr. Judy just said, as a false choice. And I didn't realize it was a false choice, because I didn't know about the alternatives. And what I then started to find out is the connections of the people that were putting on the table this thermite story, namely this Dr. Stephen E. Jones character. I found out later that they had a connection to the energy question, in terms of, you know, as we were talking a few minutes ago before we came on air, the cold fusion scenario, and he was involved with that. And of course, cold fusion is an energy phenomenon. And when I found that out, that made me realize how important, or, you know, what Dr. Judy was doing at the time, because she'd been saying for you know, quite a long time before I discovered this Jones connection. I wasn't the first person to discover it. You know, it was posted on YouTube somewhere. I didn't originally post it or anything. And so she'd been pointing out this idea of using directed energy weapons, and it wasn't just an idea.
How I came to it was through the dust,
yeah,
and through the cop car, because of my background in interferometry. Interfering optical beams in my lab, but I know what constructive and destructive interference look like.
Right.
I mean, there's these cars under FDR Drive where the front part was toasted. What I mean by toasted, it's beyond repair. It's toast. It's history. It's not necessarily from heat, but it looks like it could be. You know, it's just destroyed. Something happened to it. And then the back end looks like it's brand new on the showroom floor. Brand new wax job, is an abrupt difference between the front and the back. Very abrupt.
Right.
And that you don't get from heat. And on the other side, there's a circular spot. And that's what I started thinking about interferometry. And that started working with all sorts of things. And I started noticing from the dust on up, and everything, like it's like finding somebody gave me this example recently, and I think it's excellent. So it's like finding a body with a bullet hole in it, and right. you've never seen a gun before, but right. based on your forensic study of that body with a bullet hole in it, you know that guns exist.
Uh-huh. You might not know what they look like, but you know there's some sort of device that creates that net
right.
effect.
That's right. what I came up with.
And what you know, I eventually realized is that what Dr. Judy was doing was different, fundamentally different to what everyone else was doing, in that she was looking at the actual evidence of what was there, mm-hmm. and she wasn't drawing any initial conclusions. She was looking at all the possibilities that she could find, and what you know, and what the evidence was, and what the evidence was telling her. And you know, then I began to realize, and it took me quite a long time, that I hadn't really been doing that. I'd been basically, you know, just looking at what these supposedly knowledgeable people had concluded, you know, and I was taking that on board without really, you know, studying the actual evidence thoroughly enough as to what that was based on. In other words, the fundamental thing here is, if you want to find the truth, you have to look at the evidence. And as I say in one of the presentations I give, you know, if somebody is convicted of a crime, you know, years and years ago, then you at some point some new evidence comes to light, and which proves they couldn't have committed that crime, unfortunately in this country we have a right of appeal, and that person can then, you know, that case can be retried, new evidence can be put in under scrutiny, and the verdict can be changed, and that process, this, you know, this appeal process and this review of the new evidence was not being done within the 9/11 truth groups that I was observing, you know. And when you present them with this new evidence that Dr. Judy had uncovered, they just say, "Oh no, that's not right. You know, we're not going to look at that. In fact, you shouldn't be looking at that, because if you do look at the evidence, you know, you're going to just reduce the credibility of the truth movement."
Exactly.
That's essentially what they were saying. And I, you know, again, it took me a while that I'm thinking, "Hang on a minute." So this basic process of looking at the evidence, we're not allowed to do that to find the truth, then. And that's what the majority of the truth groups are saying, because you see, the problem is that when we get deeply into this, and you know, and Dr. Judy's talked about some of the energy phenomena that she originally discovered, it's quite a long way off the radar screen, and you've got to move quite a distance to get to the, and people, you know, just want to jump to the answer. They don't want to look at the evidence, because it takes too much time and brain power and grey matter usage. They just want to jump to the answer. So the way that the truth movement was working, and again I'd fallen for this, is the answers had been pre-packaged into a nice PowerPoint presentation, and then, you know, put onto Google Video, and you just went and watched that, and then you knew what the truth was, you know. And it actually is not like that. There's much more to it than that, and the only way to find the, you know, the truth is to keep looking at the evidence. And that process doesn't just apply to 9/11 research. It applies to all these areas of alternative knowledge, you know, that people who come on your program and talk look into. So you've got to be careful, for example, as Dr. Judy is, with the directed energy weapon term itself, you know. So I don't know if you want to mention your definition of what that is, you know, because we do like to get clear.
Also starting out with, you know, okay, I figured out it had something to do with energy. It was a weapon, and it's directed, you know, they controlled it somehow, so they had energy to interfere somehow in a specific area. So it was directed energy, and they used it as a weapon. And then I had heard that term since then. I think some people assume the conventional, you know, laser beams and all that, but what else do you call a weapon that involves energy and space interfering? And we need to call it something. And also folks said, well, energy weapons don't exist. It's only in Buck Rogers movies and, you know, science fiction. So on the first series that we put out, Morgan Reynolds worked with me on that, I chose the title as the Star Wars beam weapons, because we've had the Star Wars program, you know, Reagan's SDI program, going back, you know, years. Scratch your head. What do you think they developed in there?
Yeah.
They were energy weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they're real.
They are absolutely reeling. That you can, I know for a fact that in the last 2 days, the American Prisons Department has taken receipt of a microwave area denial weapon that the military in Iraq and Afghanistan said they had no tactical use for, so it's now being peddled on the municipal authorities that run the prisons. So there's no doubt that, I agree with you, that directed energy weapons is a massively generic term, but that they exist is irrefutable, isn't it?
Right. But 5 years ago, people argued about that, and that's why I chose that name, the Star Wars Beam Weapons, because people have heard of the Star Wars program, Reagan's Star Wars program, and I wanted to make that connection. But you know, you don't know exactly how the trolls are going to twist it. They'll twist whatever you put out there anyway, so why bother to worry about it?
Right, well, that actually leads me nicely in what I was going to ask you about in that realm, because in my research for this show, I came across numerous references accusing you of claiming that this was some sort of ray gun from outer space kind of scenario, and yet I can't find anywhere where you actually say that. Can you expand on that so we can clear that up before we go any further?
I've never said it, and when I came out with this first line of evidence, which showed the bathtub survived, the seismic impact wasn't as great, the building turned to dust, there are these cylindrical holes, these cutouts in it, there's toasted cars. I had, you know, those separate pages, like a whole page full of each, and presented it in Seattle, came back, and it was the 11th of November at Berkeley. Stephen Jones gave a talk where he talked about Judy Wood's ray beams from space and space beams.
Is that where it originated, this false
story? The first time I ever heard it. It was on that day.
Very
so that term, you know, has been used by the detractors. You know, I made the point recently on another broadcast that you know, the terminology that's attached to Judy Wood's research, Dr. Judy's research, is derogatory, and basically what I would contend is that we have the physicist Stephen E. Jones, if we take him as an example of his a specialism in what's called muon catalyzed cold fusion. I mean, this guy is not stupid, yet he can't tell the difference between a directed energy weapon term and the SDI program and a ray beam from space. Now, if Dr. Judy and myself were to go around and say, well, you know,
fairy dust.
we understand, you know, exactly. We understand. Let's make it a bit more fair, though. If we understand that Stephen E. Jones says that the World Trade Center was destroyed with dynamite, you know, we think that's ridiculous. I mean, you know, we're both smart enough to tell the difference between the terms thermite and dynamite. We don't agree that it was thermite because it doesn't explain anything when you study it. It doesn't explain anything at all. But we're smart enough to actually tell the difference between the words thermite and dynamite, and we've never gone around and we've never described Stephen E. Jones's research as saying that he was describing the process of using dynamite, because we know the difference. So why is this person not taking the trouble to make the distinguish between directed energy weapons and ray beams from space? That right there is immediately a red flag, when this is supposed to be a person who should be caring about details like that if he's interested in the truth. And so this is one of the processes by which you can recognize the people who are actually trying to lead people into some blind alley, and those who are actually just saying, no, just go and look at the evidence for yourself. You know, you can form your own conclusion about what sort of person I am, but please go and look at the evidence as to what's actually being put on the table, you know, and report it accurately. Don't misquote it, don't change it, just say exactly what's on the page. Now, I suppose I'd just better mention, as we didn't at the beginning, some of the things we've already referenced, Dr. Judy's reference with the cars and things, now they're all laid out on Dr. Judy's website, drjudywood.com /WTC, is it, Judy?
Yes.
And so that, as a process of actually finding out, you know, that's like the Cliff Notes page, isn't it? I mean, maybe you want to just...
Yeah, that's why I call it the Cliff Notes page. I started calling it the aha page because I gathered all my aha moments together and pictures that particularly meant something to me that I named, like the wax spot car. And there's, I've got quite a few different categories down that page, and at the top is an index you can click on and go to those categories where there's discrete things like the timing issue. And then the stuff didn't end up in the basement. Hollow basement sounds. You progress down the page, you get the toasted cars. And you know, further on down, you get the Hutchison effect and the seismograph, and I mean the magnetometer data and the weather information.
So, for the sake of our viewers, a lot of the things we'll be referencing tonight will be referencing back to visual images, which, if you want to give us that website again for people
Dr.
to write
Judy
down.
Wood, okay, drjudywood.com, one word, but drjudywood.com/WTC.
Right. So if they can bring that up, or alternatively, I believe they can go on our site, northeasttruth.ning, and hopefully we'll have some still footage on there up, so you've got a visual, like a visual aid, if you like. It may prove useful to follow the thread of the conversation if you've got some images in front of you. Yeah?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is one of the problems in that when you get down to it, this is pretty difficult for people to take on board. And I found from talking to people, you know, I've been to various conferences and things, you know, UFO conferences and this conference and that conference, and I have a little booklet where I've, you know, printed out some of Dr. Judy's pictures into like a summary form, and whilst I'm describing, you know, what's going on, I have to show them the pictures, because if I don't, you know, they just becomes, oh really, you know, you're just making that up, you know. So you do have to see the pictures. And if I may say that one of the key points for me, and in fact one of the key pieces of evidence that has to be explained, I think, is it on that WTC page you've got the 42, or is it the 41 list of phenomena, Judy, that need to be explained?
Yes, you go it's like one page down below right below those, the first introductory pictures, it's section AA2,
right? And the key one for me was really when Dr. Judy pointed out the steel was turning to dust, because when you just see those pictures, and basically to look at the key pictures, you could see about 70 columns of unsupported steel turning to dust. And when I heard Judy describe this, I can't remember whether it was in an email or on a podcast that she'd done it or whatever it was, but I thought, wow, that is just unbelievable, because you can actually see this steel turning to dust. So when you think about that, you then have to realise, well, what can turn a steel to dust like that? Can't be a bomb. It can't be thermite. The only thing that I know that can turn steel to dust like that is a file. You know, somebody scrubbing it with the end of it and these little grains coming off it. Because it's essentially turning to dust. So in other words, what's causing that dustification process? That's, for me, the key question that I confront people with. And they always say, oh, well, I don't know. You know, you tell me. And people have, one person even said, oh, that's just a theory. No, it isn't. It isn't a theory that the steel turned to dust. You can actually see it happening, and we've got about four different videos of it. We've got one or two still image sequences. I can't remember which one or two.
Yeah, if you go to that page that we mentioned, drjudywood.com/WTC, right below the top you see this section of shortcuts with a blue bar across the top. There's three columns. In the left column, D, dustification, click on that blue dot to the left of the letter, and that'll take you right to it.
Right. And that leads us into, there aren't just the dustification issues with especially metal objects of whatever composition, is there? There's some very interesting footage that I came across of aluminium bars that seem to have, they're broken open essentially, and they look like the inside of an aero bar. People in the UK will know what I'm talking about there. There's some very peculiar phenomenon occurring.
Oh, John Hutchison's.
Yeah, in relation to the Hutchison effect, yeah.
Well, that was again one of the key things, because I'd already got in touch with Dr. Judy, as I was saying, about, I don't know, late 2006 or something, maybe. Yeah, it was probably around then. And right. I'd followed the research she was doing pretty closely throughout 2007. And then I think it was late 2007 when she'd previously had this entry on a web page saved somewhere about this Hutchison effect. And I was already familiar with the Hutchison effect because I'd seen it in a documentary. And I'll just try and describe what the Hutchison effect is, because it's basically an interference effect, to go back to the interferometry angle that Dr. Judy's got all the expertise in. And John Hutchison is basically an independent scientist, an experimental scientist. You know, hasn't got a PhD or a degree or anything, but he's over a number of years, starting in about 1979, he was trying to reproduce some of the experiments of Nikola Tesla, and he rebuilt some of the circuits, and over time he acquired quite a lot of equipment, signal generators, Tesla coils for doing high voltage electricity work. He built a new type of RF modulator, I think, to go with the Tesla coil. I'm not sure if I'm using quite the right terminology. He basically ended up, to cut a long story short, observing some unusual effects, in that he was able to make objects levitate, he was able to make lumps of metal turn to jelly and then re-solidify, you know, half an hour later or 20 minutes later. He saw stainless steel rusting. He saw the radiation from the background count drop during his experiments, and there's no explanation in physics that I know of for that, where the background radiation count should suddenly drop and then come back up when you switch your equipment off, unless of course you're going behind a lead door, which he wasn't. So he discovered all these unusual phenomena, and in the early days, in the early 80s, he couldn't reproduce these reliably. You know, he'd set the equipment up, switch it on, and it was only about 10% of the time he was getting the effects of the levitation and this sort of thing. And I'd already become familiar with that from reading a book called The Electric UFO by Albert Budden. And there's a chapter in that book called The Poltergeist Machine, which describes John Hutchison's research. It was later in a documentary in 1999 by Nick Cook. It's called Billion Dollar Secret, where John Hutchison is mentioned, and a short clip of film is shown of his levitation effects. And so I was already familiar with that. And then when Dr. Judy showed me these phenomena that she'd uncovered in the evidence, the forensic study,
that was the most fun day.
It was indeed. You know, we sort of joke about this now. That
Andrew, why is that car parked upside down?
That was it. This was it. When she showed me this picture of this car, and I'd never seen this before, I was going, oh my God, you know, this is it. This was a slam dunk. Because we'd seen all the phenomena that John Hutchison had created. We'd seen the jellified metal, in other words, in the beams in the World Trade Center, which had been stored by, is it WJ that have got that steel? It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a company that's held some of the steel fragments. We'd seen this other famous picture that's meant to be a thermite evidence, and it's not. It's called the meteor or the meteorite, is it? They call
oh,
it?
Oh, yeah. That lump.
That was all fused metal, fused material, fused filing cabinet, that was all fused together. And this is exactly what John Hutchison has done. He's fused metal and wood. You know, there's no way you can get a lump of wood inside a solid block of aluminium, except if you're John Hutchison. You can't fake that. We'd got the upside down cars, which were these police cars.
Round holes in windows.
The round holes in the windows. We'd got reports of witnesses being levitated, David Hancher being one. We'd got these ongoing effects. In other words, you know, if you go down that page, the WCTC page, you'll basically see all these effects catalogued in the evidence at the World Trade Center, and it's a one-to-one match. And again, the cars that mentioned earlier on, I mean, I don't know if you want to talk about those in terms of the distance, you know, they were from the World Trade Center.
Yeah, they're a quarter of a mile, half a mile.
Right, yeah. Because you can actually see still photographs of, as you were saying earlier on, cars where the front half of it is completely and utterly destroyed, and the back half of it's still shiny. and I believe the shot that I was looking at was a police car.
Right.
And there's a clear delineation mark between the damaged area and the undamaged area. Now, anybody who's ever seen a car on fire knows that they tend to burn themselves to the ground, essentially. And if the front end's on being damaged sufficiently for there to be no tyre left on the rim, the back end generally shows signs of wear and tear by then as well, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, unless, of course, you know, maybe some pictures will be posted by the trolls that will show a car that's only half burned. Well, probably the explanation for that they wouldn't add was that car fire was put out with an extinguisher, you know, or something. So, you know, that this is the sort of evidence and argument you'll get. But I think the whole idea of the heat phenomenon, that's another of the keys, because the idea was that the towers were, the seal was melted by thermite, but from the evidence that Dr. Judy had collected over and over and over again, it looks like heat, but then right next to that you'll see there's evidence of no heat. You'll see that in the car the upholstery is not burnt.
Yeah, there's any amount of anomalies with all this, isn't there, basically, that
Absolutely.
Require explanation. Going on, we were talking about Tesla and the various things to do with alternative energy earlier on. There's the issue of Hurricane Erin in the vicinity at the same time as well. I find this, I had no idea about this, and I was absolutely incredulous when I first came across it. But would you like to explain a little bit about Hurricane Erin?
It was interesting. I was on a radio show recently, and a caller called in and called me a liar, and the host was, you know, kind of thinking I was a liar. Like, wait a minute, you know, look at my website, there's lots of links there. It is pretty peculiar, but it was for 4 days straight, this hurricane was aiming directly towards New York City. And at 8 a.m., it was about the closest to New York City, it was right outside of town, had the outer bands of the hurricane over the tip of Long Island, and it was raining on Cape Cod. Things stopped, turned around, and that afternoon headed out of town.
Did an abrupt about turn?
Pardon me?
You mean the entire hurricane did an abrupt about turn?
Yes. Now, there was a high pressure system throughout, amazingly, the entire continental U.S. that was moving eastward. And so, okay, it was going to maybe keep the thing from coming ashore. They weren't sure. They kept calling for it to turn north here. Nope, turn north the next day. Nope, turn north. They didn't really seem to have it predicted right as far as the records go.
Right.
But, it's, you know, if you have Manhattan full of people stuck on this island that's at sea level, and you have a hurricane coming up, aren't you worried about the storm surge? Not the hurricane hitting town, but if a hurricane stalls outside of town, you have horrendous storm surges that would flood Manhattan.
Exactly. And yet there's virtually no mention of it in the contemporaneous records from the time, is there?
Right. And I've got weather report pictures, four different network images at about 8:30 to 8:32 a.m., and that's about 15 minutes before the North Tower got its hole. And so there's no reason to be distracted on anything else. They show the weather map. They show that patch of the ocean where the hurricane should be, but don't show the hurricane. One of them mentions it, but the other ones, you know, it didn't appear in any of the maps.
No, do you think they were maybe worried that it would confuse the issue if there was more than one impending disaster scheduled for that day? I'm just being facetious. You don't have to answer.
Yeah, or people are going to leave town. Well, one thing I wonder is how can you be that sure exactly how long it's going to stay that you don't need to tell anybody?
Yeah, it all sounds a bit peculiar, doesn't it? Can you just clarify for me my ignorance? The hurricane has some tie into this in the sense that through, I'm not going to use the word half, but essentially that it's the assumption somehow that the hurricane was either part orchestrated and part of it, or the power source for it, or
That's another misinformation that gets twisted up out there. That is, like, you know, the ray beam from space got plugged in, you know, the extension cord was plugged into the hurricane. No. Again, I just look at data. If you listen to the data carefully enough, it'll tell you exactly what happened. If you don't know, keep listening until you do. So I'm looking at the dust, how the dust goes up, and it goes downwind, down the eastern seaboard. I want to get a better picture. So I start looking at satellite images, you know, weather satellite images. What's that? A hurricane? That's how I discovered it.
Right.
It's totally by surprise. And because of how it was there and nobody really was aware of it, it's on the record, but kind of tucked away. Right. I started looking into what do hurricanes do. And they're, you know, a cyclonic system. The same with a tornado. And got to looking at more characteristics. One thing we know is when a tornado or hurricane's coming, all the birds leave town. They pack up and leave, so you know that hurricane's coming. There's a kind of a field effect ahead of the hurricane, an electrical field. The same with a tornado. We kind of sense, you kind of smell a tornado coming. It's not really an odor, but you feel it.
Yeah.
There's a kind of electrical energy. Well, okay, let's look at the weather data at the various airports. LaGuardia, John F. K., and Newark airports, the three major airports surrounding Manhattan, all reported thunder on 9/11. Yeah.
Right.
People remember it being nice, crystal clear, blue sky. Why do we have reports of thunder? That is indicative of field effects.
Right.
You know, what you get ahead of the storm. Okay, so we have this static field. Ooh, come to think of it, John Hutchison used to use a Tesla coil, but then went to a Van de Graaff generator to create that static field in which he interferes other radio frequency signals.
Right.
So
a Van de Graaff generator is essentially a small little manufactured version of that same sense you get when there's a thunderstorm coming, essentially, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
That static electricity buzzing the air, kind of smell it as much as sense it kind of thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so, you know, John Hutchison's thing is like, you know, in one room, if you need to supersize it, well, think of what a hurricane looks like, a huge Tesla coil. It, you know, goes round and round and round and round, and, you know, around the stem and up to the top, big plate at the top.
Yeah.
Okay, wrapping wire round and round something, coiling wire around a metal object gives you, you know, in Cub Scouts, you do this, I don't know what you have in England, you wrap a wire around a nail, plug it into a 9-volt battery, and you've got a magnet.
Right.
You can move magnetic fields and you get electricity, which is hydroelectric power.
Uh-huh.
So here we can turn electricity into magnetism and magnetism into electricity. They interfere. And there's another component, gravity.
Right. Which you can be seen through the Hutchinson effect, yeah.
And there's all these different things going on. Okay, what's the Earth's magnetic field doing? And the data I found was magnetometer readings in Alaska, six different stations. And I, you know, like to plot data to get a look at it, and I looked at it, and it's kind of, you get them all like in the average value, and they start to drift down, and then they abruptly, like a chevron pattern, start, you know, reverse direction, go up.
Uh-huh.
Turns out, right where they made that reverse direction was the moment the North Tower got its hole.
Right.
And then, okay, all the values start going up, and then they get to a value, and they roughly go horizontal. That's when the South Tower got its hole.
So there's a clear time correlation between the magnetometer readings and the actual events.
Yeah, not only that, the 9/11 Commission, the NIST report, the FEMA report, and Lamont Doherty seismograph all have slightly different times for when the North Tower got its hole.
Right.
I can tell you which one's right.
I think it'd probably be the one that correlates with the magnetometer reading.
Yeah, the magnetometer is somewhere in the middle of those values, which, you know, within a 3 seconds to one side or the other.
That's pretty close, isn't it?
Right. And then what's even stranger is when, you know, it starts trending down when the South Tower goes poof, and it goes off like over the edge of a cliff when the North Tower goes poof. And they're haywire all afternoon, and then they get back to almost normal right when the Building 7 goes poof.
Right.
And
Building 7's a whole separate issue altogether, because there's a complete absence of aeroplanes involved in that scenario, isn't it? Which is something I wanted to get on to with you later on.
Yes, it's the same with the other ones. It's okay, I'll stay out of that.
Yeah.
But one thing I would like to is another interesting thing that I noticed is in the North Tower, you got the airplane hole went from north to south. The South Tower, the hole went from south to north. The two towers went away from top to bottom. Building 7 went away from bottom to top. It's like each one is correcting the other one.
Right. I'm not quite sure what to make of that, in all honesty, Dr. Judy. It's
like something gets out of equilibrium, the other thing puts it back?
Right, yeah. A sort of synchronicity between the two. It's swaying backwards and forwards.
You know, what I think we can mention is field effects, because that's what all the evidence is showing is at play. In other words, the field effects from the hurricane. What John Hudson was doing is to do with field effects, generating electric and magnetic fields and mixing them together in particular ways to generate certain effects. So, going back to this directed energy weapon, a lot of people think in the traditional sense of a laser being a focused beam of energy, or a microwave, you know, this thing that you mentioned, which is the active denial system that's been used at the prison.
Right.
That's a microwave beam of some kind, so I understand. And it's quite a narrow focus beam where its energy is acting in one place. What we're talking about here is it's still directed energy, but it's actually the way that it's being manipulated is rather unconventional. It's actually not... We're probably looking at a mixture of directed energy things being put into a kind of an area. They're being directed into an area around the World Trade Center and potentially at the other sites where things happened as well, at the Pentagon in Shanksville. So
I would like to say the directed part is that it's directed to act on a particular area. Like, you know, why was it just those buildings and not across the street? That's very directional there. But there's an analogy that a student of mine actually came up with when I was trying to describe this to him. He said, oh, I design audio systems. You have to be careful in a particular room where you put the speakers, how you put the speakers, because you could have dead spots where the audio cancels and is no sound there.
Right.
And other areas where the bass interferes and you get horrendous sounds. That's what we're talking about. That's a field effect, an interference within that field. You don't see it, but weird things happen in those spots.
Right. So we're talking less of a sort of mind's eye impression of a laser gun that's fired a straight trajectory beam along a path, and more of a phenomenon being sponsored in a specific area.
Yes, yes.
Right. I'm just trying to get a handle on it, Dr. Judy, because
as I said,
as a total layman, it's mind-boggling.
And you don't see it. But there's different, of course, if there's different things interfering, you get more interference here than over there. It's not an exact, you know, pieces in the right place, which I think partly is why the effect on the cars went, you know, way down here and way over there, you know, half a mile away.
What we were trying to draw, we were talking about this, I think, yesterday or the day before, and I tried to draw an analogy in that you imagine, for example, you've got a still pond, and you have a boat, set, a little toy boat in the middle of a pond, and then you get four people to hurl down rocks in the corners of that pond.
Right.
And then the ripples from those rocks going into the pond at the four corners, you know, say it's a square pond or nearly square. It doesn't have to be square, but you get the idea. And the ripples are then spread out from where those rocks have been hurled in. And the interference effects will be seen where the boat is. And the boat will, you know, obviously go up and down. And, you know, if the energy is strong enough, it may even capsize and sink or break apart. But the energy that was put into the pond wasn't directed at the boat. It was directed downwards into the water. So in other words, you've got directed energy. I know I'm using a kinetic energy analogy, but you can see that the energy change which occurs in the boat is not in the same direction as the rocks were hurled in.
Yeah.
And it looks like this is the way this sort of system is working somehow. In other words, you know, there's this whole branch of physics which was essentially shut down early in the 20th century, and it's called ether physics. And I think myself that this is to do with the manipulation of the ether, which is the kind of the medium in which everything else sits, including, you know, the atoms and nuclei and all this that make up all matter. Because if you actually look at what happened to the World Trade Center towers, they basically kind of didn't burn down, they didn't vaporize, they didn't explode. They actually turned to dust, and there was an energy change there, but that energy change didn't involve an appreciable amount of heat. So it was a completely different type of effect on the matter, which seemed to be some type of nuclear process, which was essentially some type of it was triggered by these field effects, basically, and this field interference. It seems to be that somebody knows how to make matter fall apart, and the implications of this are, of course, enormous. I mean, it basically makes all the current weapons technology in the white world completely obsolete, because if you can make two buildings, the fourth tallest buildings in the world, just basically dissolve and fall apart in a period of what, an hour, that seems the priming process.
Yeah, an hour or two, yeah, an hour and a half or so.
The final event took place in 8 and 10 seconds, but that's actually one thing we probably haven't described much in these talks, Judy, about, you know, if you want to talk about that dissolving process, because I might have confused people there as to why I used that word.
Yeah, it's a lot of different words get used, and words, another thing I don't know if we've covered yet about using words for known technology for an unknown mechanism.
Yeah. There's a lack of vocabulary to describe some of these phenomena, isn't there?
Right, and in my new book, Where Did the Towers Go? I've got a glossary with these terms in it and then where to find more information in the book. These generic terms that I use sort of as placeholders for these phenomena. But there's also in my book, I cover familiar everyday things, not just about everyday things, that we're all familiar with, that illustrate this phenomena, this type of physics, that we are just directed away from seeing. One example is straw through trees. We're told it's because the straw is flying fast.
Right.
No. It's like the Hutchison effect. When you get this weird field effect from a tornado or a hurricane, you get pieces of stuff going through trees, like tubifores.
Yeah, I've seen quite a few shots of that sort of thing. It's surprisingly more common than you'd imagine. You'd think at the best of times it would be an occasional fluke, but it actually happens routinely from what I believe it was one of your websites, Dr. Judy, that I saw.
Yeah. The guy has this nice collection of them, this Russian guy. But you also get levitation. I think people are familiar with that. A car sitting on top of a tree or a telephone pole.
Yeah. They're some of the most incredulous shots, aren't they, when you look at them?
And my favorite one, this is kind of like the punchline. My critics say, well, you don't have enough energy to do whatever. Well, this is... free energy technology, and you're telling me it can't produce enough energy?
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense. But okay, where does the energy come
from? Yeah, the buildings are gone, haven't they? That's what we always say. They say, well, you can't have enough energy to do that. You know, people have said, the physicists try and argue, well, it's taking a certain amount of energy to make those buildings, they say blow up, but, you know, Dr. Judy Wright says disappear. So that energy had to come from somewhere. We know it had to come from somewhere because the building is no longer there. It's as simple as that. You know, you can't. You know, we've both been to New York and we have actually checked, and we do know that the towers are not actually there anymore. You know, we've been there. We went there in 2008, so that's not up for debate. You know, so this energy question is sort of not as relevant as people want to make it out to be, you know. That's
it can be more, because this is free energy technology, so why are you assuming that it's using energy instead of producing energy? It's another issue. But here's a more, I guess, fundamental thing. Where does gravity come from? Where does that energy come from?
It's always been one of the great debates of modern
it's
science,
right,
hasn't it?
Is yeah.
that it's still an intangible quantity. All it can do is measure its effects rather than actually identify what it is. Is that correct?
Okay, I've got another challenge for you. I don't know if Andrew's heard this one before. Maybe he has. That when I was a little tyke, our family drove through Topeka, Kansas the morning of the 9th of June, 1966. The night before, there's this horrendous tornado that went through and like tore out half the town. I don't know exactly how much, but it was a significant. It was one of the biggest disasters, tornadoes in U.S. history. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing a house, an apartment house, sliced in two. You could see a bed was made in there. You could see some books on the dresser, and you know some other. It was just sliced, mm-hmm. and it reminded me of like. The World Trade Center, Building 4, you could look in and see what was on the desk. Looked like an X-Acto knife, sliced it off. And all of this humongous damage from this tornado, are people expected to get out a calculator and see if a tornado could have done that?
Yeah, of course.
But more than that, where did that energy come from?
This is the great debate, I think, isn't it? It's that on one hand, they're claiming that the energy isn't there for free energy. It just doesn't exist. And on the other hand, they're trying to explain...
Where the tornado get... if all this destruction that just came out of nowhere for a tornado.
Yeah, it isn't just wind, is it?
Nope. And they can just appear suddenly.
The inference from all this, I suppose, is that they clearly... It suggests that they've achieved the ability to harness this power. And that leads me quite nicely on with a very expansive question by one of our regular listeners, a guy called Vin. He wants me to ask, what do our guests feel could be useful solutions to what ails the world? Which I'm interpreting to mean, if they can harness this for the evil means that they're using it for, is free energy the answer to what ails the world?
I believe so, but it changes everything. And, you know, he who controls the energy controls the people, and he who controls the people doesn't want to stop doing that.
Gotcha. And free energy is by definition free, so there's no profit to be had in it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, the way I look at this is it's an energy issue, and that's, as we were talking before we came on, I think before Judy joined us on Skype, was... you know, basically, people say to us, oh, well, we know that 9/11 was, we know that the official story is false, so we just have to say that it's false, tell people it's false, and the details don't really matter. You know, I don't really care. This is other people speaking, not me. I don't really care whether it was bombs that did it, planes with pods, planes without pods, thermite, nukes.
Mini nukes.
I don't care. Mini nukes, you know, bubble gum. I don't care what did it. We know
Bush did it.
Yeah, we know that Bush was involved, you know, and we need to put up an international war crimes tribunal and all that stuff. But the point is here that we're talking energy, and this, to me, explains... I used to think it was just commercial interests which were preventing free energy technologies from coming into our homes and our lives. I purely thought it was commercial interests. Having, you know... come to the understanding that Dr. Judy showed me and us and the world, I now realise that there's another dimension to this. Yes, the commercial interest thing is there and always will be because of oil and gas and fossil fuels and all that stuff, but there is another, probably bigger problem, and it's that there is some group which is not too far away from us. I don't know where they are exactly, but they're certainly paying a close attention to what's going on in our lives. They've got this technology, they've got the energy technology which can liberate free energy from the ether, if I can use that word. Other people may use a different word. And they've already weaponized it. So that group is calling all of the shots. And unless and until we recognize that that group exists, then we ain't even going to look to see who it is. But I think President Eisenhower in 1961... he gave us a clue because he basically said, you know, beware of the military-industrial complex, uh-huh. And what that can do to our culture and our society, and that's essentially what he said in his 1961 speech, which I, if people haven't heard this speech, I think it's about 15 minutes long, it is absolutely vital and essential viewing because it explains a good proportion of what has been going on in the events around 9/11 and probably the groups that are responsible for it, or if they're not responsible for it, then they know, those groups know who it is. And that really takes me into another area which I'd like to discuss and make sure we get covered, and that's the whole idea of doing the 9/11 investigation. And what I mean by that is I was sucked into this truth movement which said, oh, you know, we need a new investigation into 9/11, so let's all get together in a group and let's say we'll go and write to our MPs and we'll say we need a new investigation into 9/11, let's get one now, you know, sorted, we need it. And I was caught up with that to a degree, not a huge degree, and then again I came across what Dr. Judy was doing and I realised there was a very important difference. She wasn't going round saying, oh, we need a new investigation. She'd actually knuckled down and actually started doing it in, you know, with all the resources that she could bring to bear, and she was using her professional expertise as well as the available evidence, you know, and there was a substantial amount of evidence available, and she was putting that together, she was doing the investigation, she was categorizing the phenomena that she was seeing. In other words, it was an independent investigation, it was completely off her own back. She'd sacrificed a lot to complete this investigation and continued to do so, so it was independent, unfunded, not attached to government. It was an investigation. Ah, we've got an independent investigation into the events of 9/11. At the very least, as far as the World Trade Center goes, because that's where Dr. Judy is, you know, focused most of the research. So people were going around asking for an investigation, and I'd managed to get involved with somebody who was actually doing an investigation. And I think we had a bit of a problem because we didn't really make a big enough thing of that. You know, we didn't actually use the right language to tell people it was an investigation. And I've had people say to me, you know, oh, well, I never considered that Dr. Judy was doing an investigation, but now you actually put it like that, I can see that, you know, I can see what you're saying, you know.
Yeah.
And then over and above that, because of the way she'd done it, it made it suitable to take it to court, and I think that's what, you know, I think we need, you know, Judy needs to tell you, tell the listeners how important that is, and what the reaction to that has been in all around, basically.
Right, well, straight after the song that we're about to play, if Dr. Judy would like to explain that, because I know we spoke about it briefly before we went on air, but there's some very interesting goings on in the legal realms with all this, and reading between the lines, there's a lot more to be learned than you would first think on the face of it. So if we go to a song now, and after that, we'll pursue that line, I think, and ask some questions from our listeners. So if you want to put a song on stage. Welcome back, everyone, to Northeast Truth Radio, courtesy of TNS.com. With me tonight are Dr. Judy Wood and Andrew Johnson. Dr. Wood, before we went for our song, you were about to tell us about the legal action that you started in America. Do you want to expand on that for us?
Yes, I had a brilliant lawyer who found a way through the system, I mean a way into it, an avenue by which to pursue. We can't sue the government, but we can sue federal contractors who do fraudulent work for the government, paid for by taxpayers. And that is the QTAM case, which is a whistleblower case, which needs an act of whistleblowing. So he had me submit a request for correction to NIST, saying what was wrong with the report. That, you know, there, it violates the laws of physics. It doesn't follow this. Doesn't, you know, yeah. What about the toaster cars?
If we just explain what the NIST reports are, I'll just briefly.
Go ahead. Yeah, thanks.
Because what happened was, you know, obviously 9/11 happened, and then Congress gave a mandate to a government agency, I don't know if agency is the right word, government body perhaps, called NIST, which is the National Institute for Standards and Technology, and they were tasked with producing a set of reports to explain how and why or really how the World Trade Center building.
No, how and why? How and why?
How and why? Okay, and so they were given, I think, was it $15 million or $16 million?
About
around that sort of sum. And I think it took them, was it two years to do, was it? I think it started in 2003, didn't it, I think? And then published in 2005. 10,000 pages of reports with various sections, you know, fire safety reports and some irrelevant stuff, and how the supposed planes, you know, made the steel weaken and all this rubbish. And so those then became the taxpayers' reports to explain what happened to the towers, you know, and that was the official scientific position that was given to the US people and the world, as to say, right, that's it, we know how the World Trade Center was destroyed, and that's that. And just to give you one example that was in there, which Dr. Judy might give a bit more detail on if needs be, but if you go into that report, you'll find a company called Underwriters Laboratories, and they were tasked with reconstructing the steel structure, and I think, you know, things like some of the sort of concrete layers or whatever, the way they
in the floor trusses and
the floor trusses, and they were tasked with reconstructing that to, you know, the original specifications or as close as they could get. So they set it on fire, and they burned the simulated floor for twice as hot for twice as long, and the floor didn't even collapse, didn't fail. But they signed off on their report to say that that was a valid explanation for how the floors collapsed.
Right, and this alludes back to the pancake effect that was the original official.
Yeah, the official story. That's right. So in other words, their experiment and reproduction did not reproduce what happened to the World Trade Center. Yet they said it was still valid. And
they did four tests. Yeah, four tests and four out of four.
Okay, yeah. Right.
Well, just to fill in slightly on the background, the Underwriters Laboratories that you're referring to there, they're the people that basically measure how long it takes to burn, blow up, or in any other way get into a safe. That's one of the things that those people do. Whenever you buy a big fancy safe in a bank vault, it has an Underwriters Laboratories designation.
Quality control.
Precisely, yeah. So they're supposed to be the acknowledged experts on that sort of thing, aren't they?
That's right. And then going on to that you know, you mentioned sort of the quality control thing. Well, that was what essentially Dr. Judy was challenging NIST under. There's a US law called the Data Quality Act, the DQA, which the attorney had identified that as an avenue for challenging NIST. In other words, their data should be verifiable and of sufficient quality to be up to the job that they're paid the money to do. And Dr. Judy was able to point out in a 50, I think it was 50 page document, the original RFC, was it?
And then more later. I had some appendixes.
Right, and so that's what you did, isn't it? That's so if you, you know, sort of take over from that.
Yeah, and the initial one, and also one of the appendixes I filed right afterwards, was noting a conflict of interest that two of the major manufacturers and developers of directed energy weapons were the biggest contractors that, you know, most number of people came from any one group that NIST had hired.
Right, they're all from within the military industrial complex.
Yes, yes. And not only that, does one particular one, the Applied Research Associates, and So NIST said, "Oh, we didn't know there's a conflict of interest. You need to show us that there's, you know, we weren't supposed to. We didn't even try to figure out the collapse. Our physics do stand up to scrutiny because we stopped evaluating it before the tower came apart. We didn't evaluate the collapse."
So your law case was essentially that they'd fraudulently submitted technical data that's veracity was easily questionable, and that is fraud because they were killing the taxpayer for that.
Yeah. Right. We have NIST admitting fraud. NIST, you know, even though they're mandated by Congress to investigate how and why the towers collapsed, they admitted right away that they didn't. And in writing, when they responded to my request for correction, they said, "Oh, we didn't analyze the collapse. So, you know, we aren't held accountable for whether or not it obeys the laws of physics or a scenario does." But they thought I did. Well, they claimed I didn't prove that there's a conflict of interest because the ERA has anything to do with directed energy weapons. So when I did the appeal, I had a whole host of things, including a federal grant that paid ARA to know everything about any weapon of mass destruction that existed on the planet or was being developed on the planet or probably off the planet too. In other words, they would know not only what technology it was, but probably whose technology.
And there was a pedigree to this, because there's a website anybody can look at, and it's called DEPS, D-E-P-S, which is the Directed Energy Professional Society .org, www.deps.org. And ARA, this group, Applied Research Associates, they were one of the founding members of that group, Directed Energy Professional Society. And, you know, they have these various sponsorship levels of silver and bronze and gold, I believe. And so there is a whole, sort of machinery there of research and companies actually developing directed energy weapons. And in fact, three of them were named as contractors who in Dr. Wood's KETAM case. And we've had Boeing was actually the third one, because Boeing, they were involved with the developing the directed energy, the airborne laser, which is was billed as America's first directed energy weapon, at least in the white world, of course. And so we had those three contractors, Boeing, Applied Research Associates, and another company called SAIC, which is Science Applications International Corporation, who I had previously heard of in stuff I was researching into the Disclosure Project, because they're a company that seems to be a benefactor of significant size in the black budget. And Science Applications International Corporation, it turns out, were in charge of the communications at Ground Zero from the time the event happened. And then they were in charge of security, I believe. Isn't that right, Judy?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So we've already got this very smelly kind of situation arising with these conflicts of interest. All the evidence is there, and going back to what I was saying just before the break, nobody wanted to talk about this. When I tried to post this stuff on the UK 9/11 forum, it was essentially, it was saying this was just speculation, or there was no evidence, or in some cases the thread that I started was moved into the controversial section. Even though you could go and check all of this, you could check, go onto this website, look at the contractors, find out who they are, then you could go onto Science Applications International website, look at what they did, look at what ARA did. You know, you could see that this was all public, on the public record. We weren't making this up. Yet nobody wanted to know about it.
The head of ARA's team on the NIST report presented technical papers at engineering conferences on directed energy weapons. Yeah. There's something I wanted to add is when the common, what I call them, Easter eggs, you know, they're laying out there for any three-year-old to find, and they think they found something. On the afternoon of 9/11, there was a fellow from New Mexico Tech that said, "Oh, that's obviously bombs in the building that did that. It's obviously controlled demolition." And then 5 days later, he retracted it, as the story goes, and then got $85 million in government grant money.
Was this Pat Romero, was it?
Yep. Yeah. Well, Andrew had mentioned Directed Energy Professional Society. They have annual meetings.
Right.
1 year before 9/11, Van Romero taught a short course in directed energy weapons.
Right.
Yeah. And I'd like to
from
just
a layman's point of view, that most if the directed energy weapons themselves are conspiracy theory to the average person in the street. They have no idea that. I mean, if they don't exist, how come there's professional associations for main place?
Yeah,
it's a little bit bizarre, you know.
There's one little add-on to that I try and sort of mention to people as well. You know, we've established the energy connection not only from this angle, but through people like Stephen E. Jones, who are supposedly legitimate researchers. But there's another angle that people who've looked at the 9/11 conspiracy stories, or whatever you want to call them, will know of the story of Norman Mineta. And Norman Mineta was the transport secretary, and he was the only official that was held over from the Clinton administration to the Bush administration. He testified before Lee Hamilton of the 9/11 Commission, and he basically tells this story of being in a bunker with VP Cheney, Dick Cheney, and this young man came into the bunker as the plane was approaching the Pentagon, and said, "Sir, the plane is 20 miles out. What should we do?" And Cheney didn't react, and he said, "The plane is, 10 miles out. What should we do? The plane is 5 miles out." And then Mineta tells this story that the Cheney whipped his head around and the chap said, "Does the order still stand?" In other words, the order not to shoot down the plane. And that Cheney is reputed to have said, "Have you heard any different? Of course the order still stands." In other words, the implication that that Mineta was making was that Cheney should have ordered the plane to be shot down, and he didn't. So he was trying to sort of finger Cheney for being a lie hop. He let it happen on purpose when he could have stopped the attack on the Pentagon. Now, this is again, as Judy mentioned, this is one of these Easter eggs. People think, that's it.
It must have been a plane.
It must have been a plane. It must have been Cheney lying, because Cheney's a Republican git, and we know that he's bad. But
can
then
I do
you
that
go,
one?
Sorry?
Yeah, can I do that one? I love this one. Talking about the 50 miles out business?
Yeah, totally, if you want.
So, he's saying that, the young man, asks, the order still stand, and he goes back to the radar room and comes back, and the order still stand. Well, think about it. If the plane's going, let's round it up to 600 miles an hour, 500, whatever, how fast does that airplane go, travel? How long does it take it to go 10 miles? 1 minute.
Seconds, I would have thought.
How fast can that kid run?
But the point I was going to make about Mineta himself, from this anomaly with the distance, is that I had a funny feeling about this story. It didn't seem right. It seemed like one of these Easter eggs, and I started to think in this way because of working with Dr. Judy basically and what she found. And then I found out that Norman Mineta, before he was Transport Secretary, he was Vice President of Lockheed Martin, which is one of the other big defense contractors, and lo and behold, they make directed energy weapons. So you've got all these connections running through the thing, and they're not immediately obvious. So if we go from that, I think, to the actual what happened with the RSC, the challenge, in other words, to NIST, which Dr. Judy's already described a bit, and then describe the next phase, that's probably quite important for people to understand.
Yeah, the picture I have that I call it the bubbler, it looks like a drinking fountain, except it's made out of dust. That's the picture I ended with, and I said, my intellectual integrity prevents me from calling this a collapse. They determine that's a collapse. I mean, confronting them with that, to me, is like, how can they be that dishonest? Anyway, we'd already submitted it to a federal case. See, just the act of submitting it to NIST qualified me to be a whistleblower. I was the first person who had submitted such a thing about the building in the fraudulent report, and these contractors committed science fraud.
Yeah.
And we can go after them for that. So the case is sealed, and they finally unsealed it. Morgan Reynolds filed one about what planes? You got to show evidence of planes. And that was a separate case. His was unsealed pretty much immediately. Mine was unsealed in about 6 months. And, he had the military industrial complex as the defendants. They have a bank of lawyers, working on things from all angles. And you submit, stuff back and forth. Okay, it finally goes to the first judge. They request to get dismissed based on anything they can think of. And that judge grants it to be dismissed because of, he lumped together my case, Morgan's case, and another one, and said something about planes into my case, and something about, energy weapons into Morgan's case, and had bombs in the building, all of it mixed up and muddled all together. And, it was not, they had me, they contended I was blaming the U.S. government, and I was not. Anyway, my lawyer then filed a motion to reconsider, and the same day it was denied. So we appealed it to the Court of Appeals. And I think those judges have some decency in them. I hope I'm not, you know, exposing them or getting them in trouble by saying this. I'm just being honest. I think they treat me with great respect.
Well, they even granted us a hearing. Funny you should mention that, because some of the things we've been looking at here in relation to these matters and other matters associated, we realize now we actually have the power of arrest. And if we feel somebody has committed a crime against us, you simply have to, on your right hand, your index finger, apparently, touch them on the right shoulder and say, you are under arrest. And you pass them into the custody immediately or as soon as possible of a peacekeeper, which will be an Garda Síochána Conna, or the sheriff. Sheriff comes from Shire Reeve, which is the county Reeve, meaning peace officer. You pass them into their custody to be brought up in front of a judge at the soonest opportunity. Anybody and everybody can do this once you are sovereign. You must be sovereign first.
Yeah, that's right.
And once you anybody who assists whoever you arrest from not being brought in front of a judge, they are committing treason. And they too can be arrested.
That's fraud. You don't have to have been paid for that and show the paper trail, because before they're getting out of it with a shell game of whose job it was to do whatever, and were they paid to actually file that piece of paper. If you allowed that person over there to file a fraudulent report, you're guilty.
Right. So they actually changed the statute, if you like, to remove a lot of the previous ambiguity and loopholes out of it, and made it a much more easily defined and loose and...
And there's no way they could get out of it. It was pretty open and shut.
Yeah. I think the thing to add into the mix of this little thing was the original judge's ruling from the first case also mentioned the assassination of JFK and the moon landings. It looks like he's basically copied something off a forum where they're trashing what Dr. Judy's done, and he's copied that directly into the court ruling. You know, and you can go and read this. It's all posted on the Keytan page on Dr. Judy's website, so you can actually go and read for yourself the exact words that he used. And why the case was appealed was obviously because we needed to appeal it anyway. But the evidence was not even discussed in the ruling. They didn't discuss any of the evidence. So how can you judge a court case without actually discussing the evidence? The answer is you can't. So that's when Dr. Judy put it onto the appeal court.
Right.
So the those judges. Well, when they a little bit later, they write their, after the in-person hearing, they write their decision. And in that decision, in one of the footnotes, it mentioned this new law, FERA, FERA is the name of it, Fraud Something Recovery Act. And they stated, they acknowledged this law applied to my case, but, quote, for the ease of dismissing, you know, this case, they were ignoring the law. That's an act of kindness and respect for them to do that.
It definitely, for them to acknowledge that they've done it, and it clearly shows that there had to be mischief and shenanigans going on for them. I mean, those of our listeners that are into the sort of law side of it will know that in an appeal court decision, you're putting yourself on very dodgy ground by acknowledging that you've ignored the actual law in order to dismiss a case. I mean, that in itself would be grounds for appeal or a mistrial if it were...
We appealed it to the Supreme Court. But they've changed the law so that the Supreme Court can pick and choose if it feels like hear the case or deny it for who knows, for whatever. They don't even need to give a reason.
Right, so there's no compulsion for them to hear a case of charges that are filed anymore.
But there's a silver lining here, or gold star here, is that here we had as defendants the military-industrial complex, and they have a bank of lawyers who are just itching to teach me a lesson, and get me sanctioned for filing a frivolous case,
right?
And at each level, they each one of them had filed wanting me to be sanctioned. The judges denied it each time.
Well, that speaks volumes as well, doesn't it? Because you don't get away with filing frivolous cases all the way through the chain without being punished for it at some point. Unless the people hearing the case daren't punish you for fear of you. I mean, they must imagine that it's only a matter of time before the merits of your case are acknowledged, and in which case they're going to look more and more foolish if the more... They're going to have to explain the behaviour after the fact, aren't they? And I think they've got that clearly in mind, even now.
And even footnote 19 of the first decision threatened us to not file because we get a sanction or something. It was a threat not to appeal it.
Yeah. They've obviously used a lot of pressure on this, haven't they?
But I do feel sorry for the judges, too, because I can't imagine the pressure on such a case. If it could even ever be heard. And here's what my take is on why they had to dismiss the case. If you think about it, this involves classified technology. Somebody's classified technology. It doesn't need to be the U.S.'s or someone else's. If you're going to, you know, discuss somebody else's classified technology in a civil court, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
The U.S.'s classified technology in a civil court, no. Okay, you can have it behind closed doors, but in doing that, what are you acknowledging? You can't do that. So it's a catch-22.
Yeah.
That's right. I think the other thing to point out as well is that the knowledge of this court case was very restricted. And in fact, going back to September 2007, and it was quite close to the anniversary then, so that's 3 years back now, that was just around the time, I think it was just before the 2007 anniversary of 9/11, that Dr. Judy's case was unsealed. I think it was maybe a week or a week
and a half. It was the 12th.
Of September, was it? No.
Yes. 12th? The 12th of September.
Oh, that, maybe my recall is inaccurate then, because
we didn't announce it for a week.
Right, because I did this press release in 2007, maybe I was just writing about Morgan's case then or something.
No, we did that like a month later or several days, a bit later.
Right. Well, anyway, the date is not quite so important, but what actually happened was I wrote this press release summarising what we've just discussed as it was then, in the Data Quality Act challenge and the request for correction and then the KETAM, the foundation for that, and I put it into a press release. And I sent it round all the mainstream media in this country, in the UK, and I posted it on a few websites. And I posted it on the UK 9/11 Truth Forum. And then Tony Gosling, who runs that forum, moved it from the news section into the controversies section because he thought it was controversial, even though all the documentation was there and you could go and read the court file documents, etc., etc. He seemed to think it was controversial. And I asked Annie Machon to actually talk about these court cases. This was later, it wasn't at 2007, I think it was 2008, to talk about these court cases when she was doing talks about 9/11. And I didn't expect her to go into all the detail that we have tonight. Obviously, you know, that's unfair to expect anyone to do that. But it's actually a very simple concept for somebody to say, Dr. Judy Wood, she's filed a court case in the USA against various contractors who helped write the NIST reports, and it's to do with how the World Trade Center was destroyed. I mean, that's what, 20 words, 25 words? There's no big words, no complication there. Anyone can report that news and then just say, well, I'm sorry, I don't know all the details, but if you go onto this website or Google it, you'll find the details for yourself. Now, I asked Annie Machon to talk about this, and she refused. So I don't know what's going on with there, because Annie Machon and people like her, people like Ian Henschel, for example, in the UK, claim to be interested in reinvestigating the events of 9/11, and yet they have completely censored any presentation of the facts about these court cases. So that, to me, is totally inconsistent with any desire to have a real independent investigation into the events of 9/11. And of course we can immediately transfer that description to the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth Group, to the recently formed Scientists for 9/11 Truth Group, to the Patriots Question 9/11 Truth Group, who took Dr. Judy off their webpage at some point. I can't remember when it was. Maybe Judy can elucidate on that. The person that's doing the most in terms of actually trying to get a result is actually not
hidden.
Yeah, it's hidden under the carpet. We don't want to have this person on our website. We don't want to talk to her. We don't want to look at the evidence. We don't want to know about the court case. In fact, we'd rather just say, this doesn't exist and we don't want to deal with it. Thank you very much. Next, you know. Mm-hmm. That's essentially encapsulates the attitude that we've been essentially dealing with, shall we say, in our own way, for the last, at least the last 4 years, really, but particularly in the last 3 years.
It's interesting to note how fast reputations end up hanging on the party line with these things, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
How can you have a controversial category within the truth movement? It's all just relative anyway.
You tell me.
Yeah, it seems a bit strange, doesn't it? It alludes back to the issue you were mentioning earlier on of, if you go looking for the answer to a question, be very suspicious of answers that appear to have been left right at your feet.
Yeah, exactly.
If they won't swallow explanation A, then make sure explanation B is not too hard to find.
And that's right.
They'll swallow that, thinking that they've been very clever, when in actual fact, a lot of this stuff's controlled response, as people use the phrase.
Absolutely.
I just say, sometimes when I look for clues, I try to pull them in from everywhere. There's a couple of people I've gotten excellent clues from, Greg Jenkins and Stephen Jones. They're pretty good at pointing exactly where to look. You just have to look at the opposite direction of where they're pointing, 180 degrees. Because they do a good job pointing exactly 180 degrees from where you need to look.
In some ways, then it helps you dismiss the bullshit, frankly, by looking at where certain people are pointed and then go, well, I don't have to go look in there if they're trying to get me to look there. Then
Greg Jenkins was, all the dust went down, none of it went up, and it's all real coarse.
And
the dust is fine, and it goes up. Okay, I'll go look at that.
And I think, what we've been discussing in terms of, I particularly encountered this with the Hutchison effect, because I became, as I said earlier on, sort of involved with this phase of Dr. Judy's research in terms of the Hutchison effect. And the moment that she started talking about that on the various podcasts and the odd radio show that was being done then, in fact we went onto a local radio station called WPFW in January 2008, so that's getting on with it, not long before, 3 years ago, amazingly enough. And we talked about the phenomena, with the bent metal and the levitated cars, and I made this into a DVD, and people can go onto my website, checktheevidence.com, and they can get the DVDs about this. I basically send them out for free if people haven't got any money, or just basically a donation to cover the cost of, 50 pence or a pound to cover the cost of my materials. Yeah. And they can have a copy of all this information and see what they make of it. And we went on and did this presentation on the radio, and I think it was about 2 days after we did this presentation that the people who we'd formerly classed as friends, who are two characters called Jim Fetzer and Ace Baker, friends certainly in terms of supporting Dr. Judy's research, to cut a long story short, they started attacking us, saying that John Hutchison was a fraud, despite his record of evidence, which was by that time almost 20 years old. So the moment that we were attacked, almost from the point we came off air, there was this basically an orchestrated attack against John Hutchison, which became quite vicious. Mm. We were pretty, the old saying that the flak gets strongest when you're over the target. Yeah. That was additional verification, not so much from the forensic physical evidence, but from the reaction to that evidence. And I basically, I knew that Dr. Judy was on the right track before that, from January 2007, because that's when this pattern of attacks had started to really become clear, and this is when this Jenkins affair took place. And I've written a whole book, it's really a collection of articles, over a period of almost two and a half years, documenting everything in terms of how the cover-up is working. So that's really the roles that we've fallen into, in terms of Dr. Judy has uncovered all this physical evidence, tons and tons of it, and I've kind of like been on the sidecar looking at all these people saying, no, it can't be that, can't be that, can't be that, going into their emails that they sent me and picking out particular phrases and reasoning that they've used and tried to dissect that. So I've kind of tried to do it as kind of an investigation of that side of things, an investigation of the actual cover-up, which we know, you know, is happening. We know that these military-industrial complex contractors helped to write the NIST reports. We know that there's a conflict of interest. And that seems to have been extended into the 9/11 truth movement because of people essentially trying to cover those things up. In other words, it seems there is some connection between these military-industrial complex contractors, and figures within the 9/11 truth movement. For example, we know that Steve Jones was at Los Alamos National Laboratories for a time. He makes no secret of that. Same with Colonel John Alexander, who's not particularly in the 9/11 truth movement, but he crops up talking about UFOs and stuff like this. So all that information is on my website, checktheevidence.com. There's a free book that people can download. We've got essentially a historical archive of the last 3 to 4 years cataloguing the development of Dr. Judy's research and how it's been essentially been covered up. That's all available for public scrutiny. The only obstacle for people is one of time. So, you know, that's really the thing that people can look at if they want to say, well, why is this being covered up? How is this being covered up? Why haven't I heard about the hurricane? All those sorts of questions are answered, or I hope they're answered, or attempt to answer them in the free book that's on my website.
Right. Well, I will try to remember at the wind up of the show, and if you can mention your websites again and any relevant areas where you could direct people to go and look. I'm sure there'll be plenty of people that wish they had a pen earlier on to write them down. So if you keep a pen and pencil handy, pen and paper handy, at the end of the show I'll try and remember to give you these websites again so you can go and look for yourself, because there is some really mind-boggling stuff out there. And we're going to go to a song again just now, and after that, if you'd like to talk more about the various pieces of obfuscation and misdirection that's been going on behind the scenes of this, because it's actually leaving a trail of rice back there, as you say, the flacker it's heaviest, the nearer the dragon you get. So we're going to go to a song now. We'll be back with you in 5 minutes. We're from northeasttruth.me. We've got the northeasttruth.com site. We've brought to you by tnsradio.com. So I must remember now to say thanks very much for all their help and cooperation. We really appreciate it. Tonight we're talking to Dr. Judy Wood, no relation, and Andrew Johnson. Before we went to the break, we'd discussed some issues. Can you just crack on straight with that?
Yeah, I mean, what we were basically talking about was how, you know, Dr. Judy tried to bring this information forwards, and it's essentially been trashed at almost every opportunity, and that's really not much of an exaggeration. And the so-called 9/11 truth movement, which we've come to call the official 9/11 truth movement, which doesn't really want a new investigation. They're quite happy to, you know, sing songs about get somebody else to do the investigation, but when you actually present them with any evidence, they will say they're not interested. And one particularly popular group is Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. A few of the listeners may have heard of this group, and this was started, I think, in about 2007, around about, curiously enough, I think it was almost the same day that you filed the request for correction, was it, Judy, or a week after or something?
Three weeks later.
Yeah, so it was around the time that the Judy had started this legal process, and we privately have discussed, you know, whether these two events were connected. But anyway, this group, they they had a press conference last week, and it was pretty insufferable, actually. They've now got billboard investigations. They proudly proclaim on their website, A11911 Truth, that you can make a tax-deductible donation to them now. So it's essentially government-affiliated.
But what that means is that they can't lobby Congress for a new investigation.
Well, there you go. You know, so, I mean, it's just, we shouldn't laugh about it, really, but to be honest, we've got to that point because we can't do anything else. We'd either just, you know, have crashed through the wall. We'd have crashed through the wall because we've banged our heads on it so much, or we would have just, we just have to laugh. Anyway, I want to read out a little bit of a letter because we've got another chap we know, he's called Abe, and he basically joined this Architects and Engineers on I-11 Truth, Abraham Afiz Rodriguez, and you can go onto my website and find this letter that he sent us, because he signed up with this architects group with this petition they run. If you sign the petition, you're said to be a sort of like, you know, a member. And he wrote to them and said, I think this was about nine months ago. He said, have you heard about the Dr. Judy Wood's research into directed energy weapons? You should look into this. And they wrote back and said, basically, we decided to remove you from our petition, our list of petition signers, because, whether you knew it or not, we have chosen to carefully limit the scope of our message to the collapse of the World Trade Center and the need for a new investigation that would specifically consider the use of explosives in bringing it down. Our message is displayed on our website in the petition and mission statement. The evidence supporting our message is also found in our website, which I'm sure you've seen since you signed our petition. Your suggestion about contacting Judy Wood and engaging in a discussion, which is what Abe suggested, with her about her theories, careful choice of word from them there, about directed energy weapons and other things, is a suggestion for action that is outside the scope of our message. We would lose more than we would gain. If nothing else, we would lose the time required to make such a contact and engage in a discussion debate whose duration would be unknown. We are also well aware of Judy Wood and her theories. The reason we don't support her or her theories is that they are outside the scope of our message. So, you know, it goes on a bit after that, but you can see they've got the scope of their message, but there's nothing, no mention of evidence, and there's no mention of truth. So... And there's no mention of the Ketam case, for example, and how this has been put into a legal framework. So they're basically happy to ignore all of that and lead all these other 1,000 members essentially down a blind alley.
But they were notified about the case going to the Supreme Court, and one of the members emailed it to Richard Gage and his core agents there. And they were angry and wrote back and said, we don't want to ever hear about this again.
Yeah, that's right. We've got this from somebody who's involved in this group. Marshall, I am not interested in the topic of this email. Do not include me on any future emails. And this was in response to a message.
Announcement that's going to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
It's very strange, isn't it?
It's almost, I mean, to be honest, you know, I've written about this, and to me, actually, although it's quite shocking to say it, and, you know, even more controversial, it looks like mind control is going on. There's some type of mind control going on here. It's almost like this, you know, I don't know how much you've looked at these mind control programs, like Monarch.
Quite a bit, Andrew. Yeah,
and, you know, the Monarch program and Project Naomi, MK Ultra, and these projects. It's almost like this thermite is like a coded activation message of some kind, you know, that's been put out into the wider community, and you get all these truthlings repeating it, and you know, and anything else has to be drowned out, attacked, discredited, etc.
Yeah.
So that's been our experience, and it's pretty, you know, it's pretty hard to deal with for people. There's a lot to take on board. I mean, let's look at a quick review. We're talking about anti-gravity technology, we're talking about limitless energy, we're talking about the fossil fuel fraud of the last 100 years, we're talking about weather control. It's an awful lot to take on board and digest and come up to speed with, but the only way The only way you're going to do it is simply by looking at the evidence. And if you like Dr. Judy and I and you want to do that, then you, it's very likely that you'll come to the same point as we have, and you'll be attacked in the same way that we have. But you'll know in your heart of hearts that you've been searching for the truth, and you've tried to continually review the evidence and listen to what it's telling you, because that is the way of finding the truth, and that's what we're interested in. And that's why, you know, I'm sat here talking to you tonight.
Yeah. Well, scientists for 9/11, for instance, should surely then follow the scientific method. And you don't start the scientific method with the conclusion and then limit the scope of your investigations to only that which will support your conclusion. These are supposed to be scientists. That's no way to do a scientific research project. It's to say, well, we won't look at anything that doesn't fit our hypothesis for fear that it proves us wrong. It's just bizarre.
I have a foreword to my book, and I'd like to read it, just the start of it, and I said, say, for the record, I do not believe that our government is responsible for executing the events of 9/11, nor do I believe that our government is not responsible for these events. It is not a case of belief. It is a crime that should be investigated by a forensic study of the evidence. Before it can be determined who did it, it must first be determined what was done and how it was done.
And that's not going to happen by them deliberately limiting the scope of the investigation, is it? So clearly there's some answers to be sought there, I think.
And I think, you know, what happens is, you know, the point about that foreword is the language that's used. It's not a question of belief, it's a question of knowledge, and the two are different things. You know, it's like, you know, people, do they believe, you know, that in the UK it's now 8 minutes to 11 at night, or do they know it's 8 minutes to 11 at night? It's, you know, there are certain things you can establish as fact and have knowledge about them, rather than having to believe they might be true or might not be true. And it's really that's again which differentiates what Dr. Judy has done from
between
most of
science and religion.
Yeah. You know, and so, and it's been able to say, actually I thought it was 10 to 11, but actually I'm wrong because I've picked up my clock and I found that the battery is a bit low on power, so I need to go and get a new battery, plug it in and check what the real time is. Mm-hmm. You know, if I can draw a quick analogy there, it's that sort of process where you're continually reviewing the evidence that's, you know, around you. And it is very tricky, it's very hard, but if you use your brain and you use what you know to be true, you know, then again you can keep moving forward on that journey and you can come to some conclusions. And that's what this is all about.
Well, I'm sure you would both agree that your position on everything at the moment is only contingent on the evidence available to you now, and if something radically comes along to radically change that, then as scientists and rational people you acknowledge that you will change your perspective.
Absolutely.
As the evidence suggest.
Yeah.
It really annoys me that scientists make these bold claims about the limits of the scope of their investigation.
Yeah,
surely
that's
they're
not
looking
a scientist.
For the truth. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's no scientist. Either you're looking for the absolute truth in this or you're agendered. And you can't try to be a scientist if you're promoting an agenda beyond the scope of the truth.
That's it.
I should never not to rant anymore.
Well, no, I totally agree. You know, I'm speaking for myself, not for Dr. Judy at all. I believe the official story of 9/11 for 3 years, and I've used that word of belief because that's what it was. I hadn't studied the evidence to know that it was false. So I then began to change my understanding because I started to look at the evidence, and that process was continual and ongoing, and it goes on to this day, you know.
Yeah.
So it's that whole process of learning and understanding through a study of the evidence which needs to be focused on. And I don't sit around and just say, oh, you know, you're an idiot because you've concluded this. I say, well, why are you saying that? What evidence have you got that you can explain to me to tell me why you think that conclusion is correct? You know, take your time, explain it to me step by step. Let's see if it logically hangs together, you know. Of course, some of that comes down to your personality. I mean, my background, as I mentioned, is in computer programming, so I've got a fairly sort of logical, analytical brain, you know.
Yeah.
And not everyone's like that, I accept that, but, you know, that certainly helps, you know, to have that, the start of that attitude, you know, to go through this.
Uh-huh. I have a logical pattern, but it's not the same as Andrew's. And mine is more of, you know, well, if this piece fits like that, and that what's over there, how does that piece interact with that one? You know, looking at materials and processes and phenomena. And it's, it isn't about jumping to the answer.
No, and you certainly can't find the answer by starting with the answer that you want to find and then only looking at the evidence that supports that, can you?
There's another issue, too, is that, you know, this issue of conspiracy theories. And by definition, research that is purely empirical cannot be have anything to do with conspiracy theory.
Uh-huh.
Because it's not about who was where and who said what to whom and who planned. Because a conspiracy theory is two or more people planning to commit a crime.
Absolutely. It's two different things, aren't they?
Yeah. But one other thing I'd like to point out, the popular chant, 9/11 was an inside job.
Mm-hmm.
Scientifically speaking, that's no different than saying 19 bad guys with box cutters did it.
Yeah, I guess so. You've got the evidence to support you.
Pardon me?
I was going to say, yeah, it's not good enough to simply say anything, is it? You've got to be able to substantiate what you're saying with evidence.
I think that particular phrase has entered the vocabulary now of this region, and it's difficult sometimes to discipline yourself in perhaps being more accurate with that phrase, because it's a phrase I probably still use from time to time, and I suppose I don't think of it in the literal sense now so much. You know, I think of it as being a way of saying that people who know that the official story is false within, you know, official bodies which should be investigating 9/11 say that they lie, basically, you know. So that's my sort of interpretation of this phrase that 9/11 is an inside job, in that it's just people who are in official capacity should know the previous official story is false, but yet they don't speak out. That's kind of, it doesn't really mean that, but that's my current interpretation of it.
My statement, I think now, a new one, I brought it off of somebody's radio show from last week. Mm. It's an inside-out job.
Yeah, that's perhaps better, actually.
Yeah. So. My own personal favourite is 9/11 half-truth movement.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, right. Anyway.
Andrew has an oath that they take.
Yeah.
Andrew has an oath that they take.
Oh yes, we've certain true 9/11 truth figures. I just made up this oath for them, and it's they put them into a court, and you say to them, "Do you promise to tell some truth, some half truth, or anything but the truth?" And you know, it seems that we've just had a couple of things happen recently, which you know, this seems pretty appropriate for to be read to them, and they can just say, "I do," and that's them covered, you know.
Yeah.
So
we should make it clear at this point that Northeast Truth isn't taking sides in any of this. We're simply perfectly amenable to listening to everybody's side of the discussion. So on that page, I don't want to be inundated with people saying, no, thermite's proved and whatnot. I'm not saying it is. I'm not saying it isn't. I'm just doing my little part to provide a...
I say about the thermite is it's no different than chocolate chip cookies. No, I'm sure in the dust you could find traces of chocolate, traces of sugar, traces of nano wheat flour,
yeah.
Nano wheat. And does that mean that chocolate chip cookies destroyed the towers?
Exactly. Well, one of the issues is as well that I don't know whether many people realise that thermite is basically nothing more than iron filings and powdered aluminium. And
it's iron oxide. Yeah, that's right.
You can pretty much find it in any centre of civilization if you go looking for it.
That's right.
Or at least traces of it, I would have thought.
I mean, I had to dedicate a whole blog to thermite because it's still go, you know, still like, it's like a Dracula film where, you know, however many stakes you stick through the heart of thermite, it still keeps coming back to life the next morning, you know, and it's a vampire that sucks people's energy, you know. And I've had to dedicate a whole blog to this called 911thermitefree.blogspot.com, which essentially is reposting what I've got on my website. Just so if people want to know why thermite just doesn't cut it, as I say, There's all the blogs on there. You can see why Steve Nee Jones wouldn't submit the thermite evidence to the same process that Dr. Judy has in terms of the RFC. You can see the response I got to that from somebody on the UK forum when I pointed that out, and how they tried to attack me for pointing that out, even though it's true. So that's a whole kind of sideshow, this whole how we've had to address the thermite evidence and explain that it can't be that. You know, they claim they've got these peer-reviewed papers, and they're not really peer-reviewed. I've also discovered a link to the formation of crop circles because of an element of this thermite study. People can find out about that. So, you know, there's all these different threads to follow, and it is very time-consuming. I appreciate that, but you know, we're just trying to speak about the evidence, and we'll continue to do that.
Clearly, I've looked into the thermite side of it, and I'll be the first one to admit that, like yourself, I was pretty much. I basically said, okay, it looks like thermite, it might have been involved, and knowing a little bit about explosives, these diagonal cut beams look very much like the work of shaped charges and what have you. What would you say to people in that who haven't had the chance to look at all the material?
You're going to take out a saw and cut down the building?
Well, yeah, it doesn't make sense, does it?
But if you were able to cut through the building, how you bust up the buildings, you cut it off its foundation and slam it to the ground. There's no seismic signal that indicates it was slammed to the ground.
Well, it doesn't explain why it did. I mean, the most compelling argument I can see, just on the, bear in mind I've only had a week to research this, is that you can plainly see that the buildings turn to dust and then fall to the ground. Now, if you demolish a building, you can watch a thousand of them on YouTube. When you blow a building up, you collapse the building, and the building is demolished by it hitting the ground, essentially. They almost always collapse intact, except at the interface where it's hitting the ground, and that's where the rubble and that is created. From the 9/11 footage, that isn't happening, nor is this pancake effect that everybody talked about in the official version, where you would clearly be able to see a process of slamming as they went down. That's not the case, it turns to
dust. I've got another easy one is, when the dust cloud went up, and it went up. That doesn't happen in controlled demolitions. It went up so much, and it was so fine that it blocked out 100% of the sunlight. And the first responders say it was pitch black. You couldn't see anything until, thank goodness, this car just went into spontaneous combustion. Then we had light.
Just happened to spontaneously combust by being covered in ordinary dust, did it?
No, they just were, because of whatever energy field, the cars are just lighting up, you know, all over. Yeah. But think of that much dust going up to the point 100% sunlight is blocked out.
Yeah.
This is it. All these things.
Bring a truth at all, does it?
I noticed somebody's asked about the explosions, and, you know, so people have been shown these other little Easter eggs like the squibs coming out. The explosive squibs, which are claimed to be the demolition explosives going off. We've got the Rodriguez story in the basement, of him being in the basement when these bombs went off. Various other accounts of explosions. But actually, if you go and re-listen to the majority of the witness accounts, actually describe explosions or explosive sounds, not bombs. And Dr. Judy's used this analogy. If you put an egg in a microwave oven and switch the microwave oven on, You'll hear an explosion sound after a couple of minutes or whatever. Does that mean that the
egg
is gone?
A bomb.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I was just going to mention about the, you know, what we think the explosives. Yeah, the explosive sounds. We've got witness accounts from what are called the first responders, the firemen and the emergency medical people who went to the towers. They had what were called exploding Scott packs on the fire trucks outside the buildings. In other words, these oxygen tanks were actually exploding, I think just before one of the towers came down or in between.
Yeah, they were on the fire trucks. Yeah, just extra oxygen tanks or air tanks.
Right.
And there's
many explanations for explosive, apparently explosion sounds.
Absolutely, but in the actual building themselves, you know, if people are coming down the stairwells and hearing these explosions going off, if we've got these pressurized tanks exploding, what are you going to find in stairwells? Well, you're going to find things like fire extinguishers, which are pressurized tanks. So if you've got this process, which is jellifying the metal or weakening the metal at the very least, happening throughout the towers, prior to the actual dustification, then you're going to be affecting the metal in the walls of these fire extinguishers. So when they're pressurized, they're going to explode. So so that is certainly one explanation I would give for the explosive sounds. And there were other pressurized tanks in the turbo toilets as well. They have pressurized tanks in them, you know, in the various sort of kitchen areas that would have had some type of pressurized tanks and inside freezers or this sort of thing. So various types of things can have caused these explosive sounds. We don't actually have people being burned, or I don't know of anybody who was burned to any great extent when they heard these explosive sounds. So, it's a very, very complicated picture when you actually get down.
One thing we didn't discuss is the glowing orange stuff. Folks like to say is molten metal. Well, the digger that's holding the glowing thing, the hydraulics still work. But the one that really captures it is, hot thing. I like to say hot things can glow, but not everything that glows is hot.
Right.
Because you have an incandescent bulb that glows and it's hot. A fluorescent lamp glows and it's not hot. It's a different process.
Yeah.
And here we have these things that look like, molten metal all over the place, but if you notice, it's sitting on paper.
Yeah.
Paper isn't burning, and these glowing orange things, whatever they are.
Yeah. I've seen a reference to a fireman apparently walking through a sheet of flame at the 9/11 debris site, and even if his equipment is fireproof, radiated heat alone wouldn't have allowed him to be strolling through this stuff, you know what I mean? It's just, it stretches the bounds of incredulity, doesn't it? There's a lot of that.
Yeah, like the story about the guys working on the pile whose boots would melt in 2 hours.
Right.
It was repeated over and over again. Like, wait a minute. If my oven is melting, the turkey inside of it is well done. And there's no reports of burned feet.
No. There's just a lot of that. There's a lot of paper
stuff
floating about. I mean, the whole area is absolutely wick with paper in it, yet that whole lot would have been on fire if there was huge amounts of heat in the area. It's just self-evident. Paper spontaneously combusts, isn't it, if there's a fire anywhere near it. So there's a lot of images that just don't ring true with all this. I know some of our listeners were asking earlier on about the wider questions about all this, particularly in relation to if this was an energy weapon, that opens the door on energy, free energy science and whatnot. Where do you think that's going, and where do you think we're going in terms of these, of this technology and the weapons that they're obviously making out of it?
Well, I'll start first. I encourage people to look at my website,
right,
because I don't think we're going to get a sponsored government sponsored institution to study this, but studying it yourself, using your own eyes, open mind, and understanding the phenomena, I think that's our best chance. And if everyone can kind of get their hands on that, we're outside the system.
Yeah. Do you think that we mentioned briefly earlier on about 2012 and these whole things about false alien flag invasions and what have you? I think that links into the issue about the aeroplanes and that. In that.
Yeah, we can touch on that. I mean, what I've got a presentation that I do on this where I draw an analogy, and I've got a clip from the 1996 film Independence Day, the film with, I think it was Roland Emmerich's film, as I recall, and there is a particular sequence in that where they show the destruction of the Empire State Building, top down, being blown apart. And I was struck when I thought of this image. I can't remember, I saw it on YouTube or somebody else mentioned this idea to me, of how similar it looked to the World Trade Center being destroyed, whatever it was, 5 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And so I made this little clip of putting the two side by side, making the point that in the film Independence Day, they were, putting this alien invasion as the main theme. And to me, when you put the two things side by side, there's an eerie kind of feeling that you get that the only thing that's different between those two scenes is one is obviously a movie, and with a flying saucer over the building, the other is real life without a flying saucer over the building. So we can consider that if there is this group who then sort of are beginning to realize that this facade of global terrorism, this fake psychological operation which has been built up over a number of years, is starting to fall apart, they may quote unquote up the ante and right. go for the alien threat. And this is what Carol Rosin said at the Disclosure Project conference, and I bring that idea in. So I certainly am open to that being put on the table as a possibility, but I think we've also got to take into account the predictive programming that goes on as well with these sorts of images that are given to us. And curiously, there are some peculiar things that you can find in movies, like there's a Mario Brothers film from 1993 where it actually shows the Twin Towers kind of dissolving. It's only about 4 or 5 seconds long, this clip, and somebody's posted it on YouTube. It's very strange. It's very strange. I'm not so sure if Dr. Judy wants to talk about this much, but I certainly see 9/11 as part of essentially a wider agenda, you know, of what's going on in the world, which has a cult aspects to it as well. That somehow plays into this, you know, with the Twin Tower symbolism and the dates and the times and everything, you know, and the other symbolism that people talk about. I certainly don't dismiss that. It's difficult to talk about it in the same way as the forensic study that's been done, but nevertheless, I look at it and I think, there's something going on with this, you know.
Yeah, there's clearly an agenda of perception management operation,
exactly.
Isn't it?
Exactly.
It also seems like when I came out with what I thought happened, and I was very suppressed, trampled on, and whatnot, and then, you know, gradually leak out different things at different times. Like when the Supreme Court denied my case, the next day or the day after was when the you remember that ABC News Freedom of Information request releases all new photos.
Yeah,
those were the photos that were in my legal case.
Yeah, there was a report on ABC around about the time of the ruling on the case, which said that these new 9/11 pictures had been discovered in an archive or something, or were being released.
They were Freedom of Information request.
Right, okay, it was a Freedom of Information request. Yeah, these were all the same pictures that had been on Dr. Judy's website for about 3-4 years or something. So,
Since 2005, I guess.
Yeah. So it was all a bit weird, you know, and we were just kind of sort of stroking our chins over this one, you know, as to what was going on. And
this big hoopla, I think they want to control the timing. Okay, now it's okay to look at these pictures. Before it wasn't.
Yeah.
And now they've released these videos. Okay, now we're supposed to learn more from the videos. Like they're cluing us in slowly.
Mm.
They don't want people to get ahead of the game.
Mm. You know, and the whole energy thing as well. I mean, it's a huge, huge issue. And to me, I think, as I said, that we have to realise that this technology is real. You know, it's not a debate. It's not a theory. It's real. You can prove it from the available evidence.
Uh-huh.
Therefore, we have to identify what group is responsible for 9/11. You know, is it an international group? Does it have connections into these Zionist movements? You know, I don't know, but it's
ERA
certainly
knows.
Something that. Pardon?
ERA knows.
Exactly.
And if that case had gone forward, we would have gotten them under oath.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we can certainly prove the connection, not to those who did it, but those who covered it up. And you would think that because people like ARA are actively covering this up, they probably have some kind of connection to those people who did it. You know, so we've at least got a thread we can pull, you know, in future to try and find out more about that. I mean, I think one thing we're going to touch on earlier was the potential of using this weapon again. And back in 2007, I'd heard a lecture by Stephen E. Jones in in Seattle, Judy? Vancouver, wasn't it? Yeah, that's right, Vancouver. And we'd had Stephen E. Jones saying, "Oh, well, you know, we're just putting a warning out here, you know, that if there's a nuclear attack, you know, somewhere, an American city, we're not going to name it. And Eagle said, oh, it was Seattle, going to be Seattle. It had been pre-wired with nukes. And Steve Jones says, well, we know, you know, there's 9/11 truthers out there, and we know that if this happens, you know, we're going to get people to go in and collect a dust sample, you know, and then they'll send it to us, you know, yeah. We'll test it for you. And he was basically proposing that people from the 9/11 truth movement, whatever that is, should go into the city that had been nuked to get a dust sample so that they could send it to him to test. And they would erase
it. Selfless, I think.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But also around the same time, we had Michael Chertoff claiming that he knew that Al-Qaeda had now got nukes and they were going to use them on American soil. And so Judy and I were putting two and two together and thinking,
Iran was going to get nuked or something was going to happen with Iran. Yeah.
Yeah, they were going to get the Israel. I think they were bubbling away that story in Iran about it having a nuclear power.
But we thought they were going to get the U.S. might do them, you know, do weapons and then let somebody else go in there and mow them down.
Yeah, I mean, what I said at the time was it looked like they were trying to set up for another false flag using nukes, or they would basically claim it was nukes, Al-Qaeda nukes that did it.
And use that as a premise to go into Iran.
Well, something like that, but they were then going to use the actual weapon again, you know, which looks like a nuclear bomb going off, and we haven't even covered that angle of it, this whole disinformation campaign, which I've documented about nukes at the World Trade Center. We thought they were going to use that as a cover, Al-Qaeda nukes as a cover for another use of the weapon somewhere. And right. And we were going to go and discuss that on this Ambrose Lane program, which was a satellite, it was on the Power XM channel. I've written an article about this. And we were all set to go on. It was going to be the first time that Judy and I had gone on air together. It was in July 2007.
Yep.
And we sat by the phone, waiting to get called to go on the program, and the call never came. So I think the next day or a few hours later, I rang the producer and I said, have we got the time right? You know, have we got the day right and everything? And he said, oh, they've cancelled the show. And I said, what do you mean they've cancelled the show? He said, they fired Ambrose Lane. They fired the host. They took him off air. So they basically
the
fired
studio.
Him. Yeah. He was driving into his parking space. And he fired the host. They fired the host of the show from the network. He was the most popular host at the time. And that was literally minutes before we were due to go on air with that. And so we thought, well, we must have been onto something with that.
And we were also encouraged by our mutual friend to describe, you know, if it's a do weapon, here's what you look for.
Yeah. Yeah,
and so they couldn't pull it off without it being recognized.
Yeah, yeah.
There's so much of this going on that it's almost sometimes it's impossible to, or
it
next
is.
To impossible to find the actual smoking gun, but you can find lots of evidence of them hiding the smoking gun, and that tells you speaks volumes in itself, doesn't it?
It does.
But
it
even
does.
If you find it, who's going to listen to you?
Yeah, yeah. Somebody's posted a question there, I see. I don't know if you want to read that one out, the last one that's come up about the loved ones.
Right, hang on 1 second. I'm not even sure whether I'm getting the same questions as you up on the screen.
Yeah, I think it's come up in the chat window. It says, do they see a method of convincing those who have lost loved ones? Are those people willing to accept what they've been told?
I think they can handle what happened, from what I understand from some of them I've talked with. They want to know. They want to know what happened to their loved one.
Certainly they have the right to know one way or the other, don't they?
I agree. I think they have the right to know. I think, to me, you know, I mean, I haven't spoken particularly to anyone. I've only ever come across one person who's directly affected by the events, who I've spoken to in the flesh. And I'm not sure. I think you're going to get a range of reactions. Some people just won't even look at it. They won't want to talk about it. And then others, like I think Dr. Judy's, you know, saying they will want to know. They will want to know everything. They need to know everything to get closure. So I think you'll get different things.
It's interesting. I mean, one of the threads that you cover is that you question the existence of any actual planes hitting the towers. Have you ever come under any flack from people purporting to have had loved ones? I mean, you've obviously just said that you haven't, but seeing as I wrote the question 2 days ago, I'm asking it anyway. But has anybody sure. actually approached you and said, like, how dare you, my son or whatever was on that plane sort of thing?
Well, curiously, the actual people aboard the planes, I've never heard of them saying they've lost loved ones on the planes. What we have, of course, people challenging us from the ground who've witnessed the planes. Do you want, Judy?
Yeah, there was a flight attendant who recently contacted me. Who? I've got to hear like a repeat echo.
Well, we can't hear it at this end, Dr. Judy.
Okay, so I'll pretend it's not there.
Yeah, I know it's distracting, but if you could.
I don't know who's talking. This flight attendant contacted me because they had never, known that there was a hurricane there.
Right.
Let's see if I can. Can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah, I can hear you absolutely fine.
Okay,
I'll
just turn on the volume. So they never realized there was a hurricane there until they saw my website. They also mentioned that they flew out an hour earlier, but their friends were there who were doing the flight, being flight attendants for the flight that was going, supposedly flight 175 going to, it went into Tower 2.
Right.
And they said those are real people, and they, never came back.
It's an interesting point that there's been. I haven't honestly looked at this in any great depth, but there is quite an absence. You would have thought with these things, with it being such a globally famous issue, that there'd be millions of people coming out of the woodwork claiming to have even the most tenuous connection with victims of either in the towers themselves or in the planes or whatever. And yet there seems that there hasn't been the degree of that probably in my cynicism I expected that there'd be people being celebrity hungry and whatnot. You think that the most tenuous connection to anybody that was a victim would grant some sort of celebrity status, and I expected there'd be a lot more of it. Instead there's been a conspicuous absence, isn't there?
They're related to people in the towers but not in the planes.
Yeah,
I mean, it's mainly the people in the towers that have come on TV and said, I lost this person in the towers, and we don't really see the same. I mean, I suppose, if you want
Jersey
to...
Jersey Girls.
Yeah, I mean, there's a Jersey Girl, certainly, and they were in the film 9/11 Press for Half Truth, I mean, Press for Truth. they've been, I think, co-opted into this to quite a large extent as well. But going back to the plane issue, I mean, I did a study of the witness accounts from the first responders, a deliberate study, and this is, I sort of basically tell people this is really the only bit of original research that I've done into 9/11 is the study of the witness accounts,
right.
And I catalogued all of that, and I put some statistics together, I made a database, and that's all on the website, and I basically discovered that from the first responders, i.e. the emergency medical technicians and the firemen, I identified 117 people who were at or inside the World Trade Center towers when this supposed second plane struck.
Right.
And out of those witnesses, out of those 117, only 21 saw the second plane, only 20 heard it, and only 8 of them saw or heard the plane. I think it was 8% or 8%, certainly not many. So it was a very relatively small number that actually claimed to have seen this plane actually come in. I mean, this is meant to be a 767 with 757, I can never remember which one it is, with jet engines that are louder than rock concert, screaming into the echoing sort of streets of New York, where you've got the sound bouncing off all these buildings and round the streets. It's going to be a huge great noise, and apparently hardly anybody heard it.
Yeah.
And so that's an anomaly. We've got people in the first responders saying, oh, when I got there I didn't know planes were involved, and in fact I didn't find that out until the next day. And you can
right.
go and actually read these accounts, which were published on the New York Times website after a Freedom of Information request in 2005. There's 500 of them. And I downloaded all 500 accounts and then did keyword searches. It took quite a while to do this,
Yeah.
So, people can look at this again. This is a different thread of evidence. This is not so much the forensic, photographs. It's actually a study of the witness accounts, and they can come to their own conclusions about the plane stories. Look at the video record. Look at Richard Hall's analysis that he's done, which was published recently, and it's been very, very interesting. Generated a lot of traffic, and really people should have a good look at that and see what they make of it. Because again, the plane story at the World Trade Center is probably more complicated than people would like to accept.
Yeah, I think we're going to go to a song now, I think, if we've got one lined up. And after that, I'd like to talk more about that, because some very interesting stuff. Obviously, we haven't even touched on the Pentagon and whatnot yet. So if we can get a song playing, and we'll be back in a few minutes, people, and we'll carry on with this.
A random thought that I was just thinking about is, you know, how much stuff we accomplish or don't accomplish. It's really, compared to my academic life, you wonder, like, how come you don't get much done? It's like you're walking through thick honey in everything you do because you're swimming upstream.
Yeah. Well, you're swimming against the tide of perception management and misinformation, black propaganda. It all has a net effect, I guess, doesn't it, on your actual output ultimately?
Mm.
Like this last week, there was somebody posted an article, and they had me and Morgan Reynolds as the author, and it was about space-based laser weapons.
Right. Well, we've already actually discussed this before. Now, to the best of my knowledge, I couldn't find any reference where you're actually saying that.
You would have that if that was still out there. They had me as the author.
Right.
Morgan. And I never wrote such an article.
No. It was copied from your website appendix, wasn't it, on one of the appendices?
Right. But it had the, you know, right up, but they, you know, they didn't ask me, and I wasn't the author either. It was just, it was in the appendix reference.
Yeah, that's right. The bizarre thing was that this person who posted this article, he claimed that he'd spoken to me about it.
Yeah.
And it was very strange, because Judy was saying, oh, he's spoken to you, and I was saying, who is he? I haven't spoken to anyone. And
it's one of those classic a source close to Dr. Judy.
Well, it wasn't quite like that, because he wasn't totally lying. He had actually spoken to me, but we didn't bring up this topic. And the last time I spoke to him was in February, so that was like, you know, 6 months ago, 7 months ago even, and we didn't talk about that. In fact, I told this guy at the time exactly what we've discussed tonight about the Hutchison effect evidence and all this. And none of that evidence was in this article that he posted. It was a complete...
It was about space beams, yeah.
Yeah, it was about space beams, basically. I think everything but that term was missing. And it was falsely attributed, as Dr. Judy said, to Dr. Judy and Morgan Reynolds. You know, it was just ridiculous. And this, you know, I mean, we get this every couple of weeks, and then we have a sort of clear period, and then the latest food fight will start. We get all these emails from people saying that, you know, so and so has said this and that and the rest of it, and you know, it's just crazy stuff, you know.
At the very worst, from their point of view, they're going to embroil you in a he said, she said sort of nonsense scenario for weeks, which will again have a detrimental effect on your ability to disseminate the evidence you've found in that.
I don't know if we should cover what Fetzer did.
In which part?
My book was supposed to be coming out last fall, and for the, like 6 weeks there, Fetzer, on his radio show, was doing this horrendous stuff, plus sending out mountains of emails to about every radio host he knew and a pile of other people, and with various rumors that he'd gotten other people to start, who later retracted them. One of which was I was having sex with John Hutchison. That's why I was promoting the fraud.
Well, how was that?
I don't know. I mean, do you have to be in the same country, you know?
Yeah. Is the Hutchison effect all it's cracked up to be then?
Yeah.
we were making jokes like this, you know. And I remember we obviously at one level it was a bit horrible that this was going on, these sorts of allegations which were coming out. We just explain who Jim Fetzer is. I mean, he basically was the co-founder of the Scholars for 9/11 Truth Group, and at one point he invited me onto the steering committee. This is what I've had to write about, you know, and this is me with no published papers, no advanced degrees, you know, nothing like that. So you know, he's basically invited me onto the steering committee. Later, when we as soon as we came up with the Hutchins effect, he described me as I was childish, and you know, I had no ability to think in terms of deductive reasoning or some of the rubbish that he came out with. So, you know, it was just this crazy, crazy story. And then, you know, as Dr. Judy was saying, he came out with these allegations of, sexual misdeeds with John Hutchison being involved, and he spammed this round to everyone. And I'm thinking, what the hell has this got to do with what happened on 9/11? It's got absolutely nothing to do with it, you know. And so we were having this sort of mock hearing, you know. And I think I said to Judy, you know, I did not have sexual relations with that man. You know, we were sort of laughing for about half an hour at that one. It just seemed so bizarre. You know, it was just ridiculous. It just got to the point of being ridiculous, and we couldn't do anything but laugh about it. You know.
But I came upon someone who told me to take the Hutchison effect out of my book. It was going to discredit me. Who had been listening to Fetzer's stuff? In other words, it was effective.
Yeah. Well, that's the sad thing about it is that unfortunately it is effective, and it's very difficult to know how to measure your response to all this disinformation and sabotage and stuff. Because to engage with it actually means you end up embroiled in it to the detriment of what you were actually doing, which of course is part of the point, isn't it? You spend so much time refuting nonsense and disinformation that you actually find it very difficult to do what you're supposed to be doing in the first place.
Here's another question. Do you think I can ever get a faculty job again?
I would have known what I know about mainstream academia. I'd be very surprised if your name's not
The internet trolls were writing to my colleagues at Clemson and posting their responses on troll forums.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
It's, you know, that's somebody's life, and there's nobody who's held accountable.
That's it. And I mean, just taking a mini step back of what I just wanted to add, something that I'd mentioned to Judy yesterday. I was at a conference at Leeds, and I give out these articles in little booklets. You know, it's just the cheapest way to deliver the information. Mm-hmm. And I've collected these articles, which are basically, you know, my rebuttals to a lot of the trash that's been posted.
Right.
And I happened to give this to one chap in the morning. I had a chat with him in the afternoon just to see what his interest was, and he surprised me because he'd actually started reading the booklet, you know, actually between the morning and the afternoon.
Right.
And he said to me, oh well, I read some of it, but it just sounds like a lot of people arguing, and it doesn't make for very interesting reading.
Right.
You know, and that's again going back to the problem you described, is there's so much of it that you get into this cycle, and it just, unless you know the backstory, It's not really that interesting to get into, you know. So this is the problem, that all this trash is generated, and it basically dilutes all the serious, important study of the evidence, and that's what it's for. And it's easy to lose sight of that, and I've lost sight of it a few times. You know, don't get me wrong, but so that's what it's for. And I think if people read that book, if they can, they'll see in real time how the misinformation and disinformation was being generated. And I've tried to write it as a kind of real time study, if you will, and if they do that, they'll then be able to see that going on. You know, another of the areas I investigate is to do with chemtrails, and I've spoken quite a lot about that, and I've seen similar sorts of things going on in that. And I've done a skills transfer from the study of 9/11 to the study of chemtrails and the study of the UFO stuff. And I've seen exactly the same sort of patterns going on, you know, so it's been quite useful for me, certainly, if not for anybody else.
Yeah. I mean, those of us who... Sorry, Dr. Judy.
I'm a member of a private forum, and one that you expect to be infiltrated. And then last night, nobody was looking, there was a couple of them that just started launching out, see if they could rile me up. I'm thinking, okay, now I know. That's a Fetzer lookalike. You know, it's, you recognize the pattern. They're trying to get people stirred around in circles, so they go nowhere.
Yeah. I mean, what the thing is, that it's a pretty formulaic as well, so when you've watched it occur a couple of times, it becomes self-evident and transparent as you've seen it unfolding for the God knows how many times. So it's less of a... It's less of a shock when you see it, and it doesn't take quite so long to see through what various people are up to, I think. But ultimately, it's very difficult to know what to do about it, isn't it?
Right, but you see it and you understand it, and you just, okay, that person doesn't exist anymore. You just, you know, wall them off because they're useless to you. You know, a troll or whatever. But other people around you haven't learned that yet, and they're, you know, still think this person is valid, and they want to know why you don't think they are, and they don't have the background, and there's no way you can catch them up on the background. That's a tough one.
That's right. That's been my experience. You know, I know people who always said, well, look, this guy is not, you know, he's not looking at the evidence. He's not looking for the truth. And they'll say, well, how do you know? And I'll say, well, look, there's this and this and this and this and this. And they'll say, but so what? You know, that doesn't prove anything. And so you're back into the same sort of cycle again.
Yeah, and they are very good at it.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah. Our most recent example with Morgan.
Well, you know, I mean, maybe now is not the best time to go into that.
We've
had a lot of people who we thought were friends have kind of, I wouldn't say nice as in the back. In some cases have been that, but they've understood where we've been going to, you know, but then they've turned around and basically sort of made us realise that they're not actually going to, you know, keep studying the evidence. They've settled on a point of view and they're going to stay there, you know, and that's pretty hard to take from people you feel you've developed a trust or a working relationship with. So, but this brings me on to a sort of more individual thing for me in terms of this is a journey, a journey of understanding that I'm on, and I'm on a different journey to everyone else. You know, there's certain parts which I share in common with other people, but it's my own understanding of the universe is growing and developing and changing, and I try and share those parts which I think will be interesting to other people with other people, but sometimes they're just not interested, you know, and they're just not ready, or not, you know, they're not sharing that part of the journey with you. And to me it's been helpful to kind of look at it in those terms, because then I'm less likely to sort of try and sort of say to those people, you're just stupid, you know, if you can't see this. I don't say that. Sometimes I feel it, but I never say it, because I tend to sort of think, well, they just haven't shared the same journey as I'm on. You know, I thought they were, but actually they're not. So, and you know, you just have to leave them to move on their own journey and end up at the destination which they've set for themselves, wherever that might be. And that's kind of how I've rationalized all of this, and that's why I'm not really interested in making a big campaign group or rah rah rah, let's do this. You know, it's actually, I've almost become quite introspective about it in some ways, actually, to be honest with you. And I just want to share this information with those who are interested and who express an interest in finding out. And I don't, I feel less and less, you know, to go back 5 years, you know, I was writing more letters and I was trying to actively get people more interested. But now I'm kind of waiting for people to find my website, email me and say, oh, I don't understand this, can you explain this a bit better, or can you send me a disc, you know, and I'll just say, yeah, you know. Uh-huh. So that's kind of where I am with it, you know.
You have to be pragmatic about these things, I guess, at the end of the day. So everyone's on their own journey, I suppose. So, you know, they have as much right to disagree, I suppose, but at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But at times I've you know, felt like a real idiot for how naive I was to walk right into the, you know, the trap that they'd put the bait in for me at, you know, the scholars group.
Yeah.
And you learn, you know, you get this learning curve, but then you see other people on the way, and you see, okay, they're at that stage I was at, and you see other stages they go through, and I start feeling like, okay, maybe that's normal.
Yeah.
I'm not you know, a loser, you know, just stupid and just got trapped because I was stupid, but it's human.
I think the difficulty is that because if you were focused on the truth, essentially, and not playing guile games and mischief and whatnot all over the place, it makes you are inevitably vulnerable to mischief makers. But and that sometimes leads us all into just going, right, I'm just not going to cooperate with anybody else, and I'll just do my own thing. But that in itself is a victory for them, in that they've managed to make you retreat to a position where you can't trust anybody to
Isolate and intimidate.
Yeah.
That's it. That's in the manual, I think. That's one of the things that these people are given in the manual. Isolate and intimidate, and you know, all that goes with it. Right. You know, I think absolutely that's true. And you know, I think it's very difficult sometimes, because once you're attacked, either physically or intellectually, you have to defend. Mm-hmm. And if other people only see your defense and don't see the original attack, you know, on a forum or earlier in a thread or whatever, or in an email, then it looks like you're the attacker, you know, you're creating the trouble, when it actually you're just trying to stand your ground, you know. You haven't attacked anybody, it's you didn't start the fight, as it were. You know, it is almost like playground schoolboy tactics at work, you know, at that level of that psychology, and that's one of the problems in all of this.
Or there's even one more step removed, is where you haven't done anything and you're being accused of having attacked some, you know, poor victim.
Exactly.
And of course you spend then all your time trying to clear the issue up, instead of doing your research like you're supposed to be doing, don't you? So
it's exactly. You know, and we had this claim from this Steve Nee Jones character he made in this lecture, that he'd been attacked by
someone told me I've been blind.
Yeah, there was that one. I was thinking in that one you mentioned earlier on, the video from 2006, where essentially he didn't say it literally, but he strongly implied that you'd attacked him.
And she's falling in with the, you know, and this professor who he lost her job. Giggle.
That one. Yeah. Mm. And so it was like he did it very cleverly and dirtily, really.
Yeah. No names, so you can't defend it.
Yeah.
I came across one, actually, that somebody had managed to embroil you in. It was the Ace Baker, the Ace in the Hole affair, which looked exactly like a classic example of where he'd accused you of sending him hate mail, and then he managed to embroil you into a constant correspondent of you saying,
I didn't ever send you hate mail.
Produce it.
And that was me, Judy. It was that's right. Ace Baker had accused me of sending hate mail, so I actually message. Yeah, I asked him to produce this message, and then in response to that, he sent the hate mail to Judy.
Yeah.
He said, "I hate Judy."
Yeah, and I think she's a co-conspirator to mass murder. I mean, you can't, you know. And then this Fetzer guy was claiming this, he didn't know if this was hate mail or not. You know, I mean, it really is.
You
know, he said that, because he said in this lofty sound that, you know, I'm a philosopher of science and I don't even know what the definition of hate mail is, you know. Mm. You know, I mean, what? I mean, unbelievable stuff, you know.
Yeah, I hate Judy Wood. That's, you know, the title of it.
Yeah, I hate Judy Wood. He actually said, I hate Judy Wood.
Yeah, he said the word.
I didn't know if this was hate mail or not. You know,
But that was a classic example, wasn't it, where you spent an inordinate amount of time having to rebut and unpick all that nonsense. And I just thought, I've seen this so many times now that I'm surprised the so-called truth movement isn't virtually immune to it. Surely we must all see it for what it is now.
Well, I think that's the thing. It's this idea of the movement. That's the whole problem of having this movement. Mm. Because once you get a movement,
belief system.
Yeah, it becomes a belief system. And also, once you get a movement which is more than two people, you know, I mean, Judy and I, we have our disagreements, you know, and we just want to do things differently, and so we just do, you know. If Judy wants to do one thing and I want to do another, I'll do what I want to do and she'll do what she wants to do, you know, and that's the way it works. We don't have a movement, we're not part of a truth movement, we're just Judy and we're just Andrew, and we happen to agree on quite a lot of things that we've talked about tonight. You know, we might disagree on every other bloody thing on the planet, you know, for all I know, but we happen to agree on these things. So it's not about movements. It's about because if you form a movement, it will get infiltrated and controlled by these incredible forces that have got this weaponry, you know. And that's just, the weapon is just one thing that they can do. If you take this technology and apply it to, you know, say mind control, what can they do? You know, what are the limits of that? You know,
there's almost none, is there? I mean,
exactly.
As you say, you are what we would call sovereigns choosing to cooperate, basically. Nothing
exactly
more than that. But
that's
the greatest threat I think they perceive. If they ever realise that we can get stuff done, in that manner, it'll be the end of their little hegemony, won't it? So it's in their best interest to get to upset anybody trying to get stuff done without accepting their infiltration, if you like.
Like Morgan and I were in the scholars group, and let's see, he roped me into, Fetzer roped me into being his webmaster, so I didn't have time to do anything else. And he said I could post stuff while he's out of town, so I posted this questioning the plane issue. Mm. And when I told him about it, he blew up and kind of threw me out of the scholars group, but then scolded Morgan for being insubordinate. Morgan says, I'm not insubordinate. I'm not your subordinate. I'm out of here. So we both resigned, and then we started being productive.
Yeah.
And then that's when we started getting the, you know, the dew weapon business going, and then, whoops, got to roll back in and, you know, get control of them again.
Yeah.
That's a whole sort of 6 months of history there, isn't it, in terms of that period that you've just described. That I think that happened over a period of about, what, 6 months, was it? That was from up until November 2006 when that phase kind of entered a new phase.
Right, and the fake, you know, breakup of the scholars group was all about me and Morgan, who weren't even in the scholars group.
Yeah.
Right. I know we started on the 9/11 issue, and it's sort of evolved into a different topic. I'd very much like to, if you would consider both coming back on again at some point in the future. I know we could talk about this till the cows come home, basically, and there's so much to talk about. It's 10 to 12 now. I'm aware that I've already kept you for 30 minutes, but beyond what we originally asked you to, I don't even know what the time difference is in the States, Dr. Judy.
Oh,
so
you're the ones who are real late. I'm you know, earlier than you.
All right,
I think
that's
it's 5 hours. What?
Great. Well, I think we should go for a song now, and when we come back from the song, we'll wind it up, and I don't know what to say. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you both, so if we've
likewise.
Got a song line. I kind of sprung that one on our tech guy here.
Sleazy snack bar, sucking sickly sausage rolls. Slipping down slowly, slipping down sideways. Think I'll sign off the door. 'Cause the fog on the Tyne is all mine, all mine. The fog on the Tyne is all mine. The fog on the Tyne is all mine, all mine. The fog on the Tyne is all mine. Could a copper catch a crooked cup and make it? Could a copper comprehend that a crooked cup and make is just an undertaker who undertakes to be a friend? And the fog on the Tyne is all mine, all mine. The fog on the Tyne is all mine. The fog on the Tyne is all mine, all mine. The fog on the Tyne is all mine. Tell it to tomorrow, today will take its time to tell you what tonight will bring. Presently we'll have a pint or two together, everybody do the thing. Swing together, we can have a wee wee, we can have a wet on the wall.
If someone slips a whisper that it's simple, sister, slap them down and slap it on their smalls. Cause the fuck on the tine, it's all mine, all mine. The fuck on the tine, it's all mine. The fuck on the tine, it's all mine.
Hi, welcome back to the closing blurb of Northeast Truth Radio. We're coming to you tonight through TNS Radio. I'd like to thank my guests tonight, Dr. Judy and Andrew, for being absolute stars and for sparing us the time. I'd like to thank Ange and Steve for putting all the show tonight together. Vin and everybody from TNS Radio and whatnot for making this all possible. A big quick hello to freemanontheland.ning and scottishsovereigns.ning. If you listen to us next week, we've got a really brilliant guest. I'm not going to tell you about it just now because I haven't had a chance to confirm it for definite, but you've got to listen next week. It's going to be great. So thanks for listening, everybody, tonight. And we've been Northeast Truth. I hope you've enjoyed it. Night, all.